The October Apple event is it's official. We got a date and a location, and we know a lot about what to expect about it. And we kind of lucked out this time, Mayo, because with the past 2 weeks in a row, we've recorded on Thursday instead of Friday, mostly due to my schedule. And this kind of worked out. We could have recorded yesterday, actually.
Yeah, Thursday instead of Wednesday.
Yeah, that's the one. So we could have recorded yesterday, and today, this week we thought, well, let's give one more day, see what happens. And sure enough, the Apple event gets announced. And, it's like October event went from a question mark in our show notes to an exclamation point. So I'm excited.
Yeah, because, especially this week, there was a lot of, Twitter murmurs of, oh, maybe they don't do an event after all. They're taking their sweet time about it, and mm-hmm. I think everybody was getting a bit anxious about it. And
yeah,
I didn't really expect it, because to me the iPad Pro hardware change is enough that I knew there was going to be an event. Like for them to release that or just do press briefings would be such a disservice to that product. So I was 99% positive there was going to be a full event, assuming the iPads were coming out, which I think is pretty obvious they are.
Yeah.
So it was either going to be this time or maybe in a couple of weeks, but I wasn't fretting about it like some other people were.
Yeah, if we would have come to next Tuesday or Wednesday and there was no announcement, I'd have been I guess something else is happening. But yeah, I tweeted yesterday that the dates of when in 2016 it was announced and then when the event was held, and we'd been looking at this October 27th number as the 2 year ago date, and this year October 30th seemed to be the right version of that. But just from memory, I just recalled it being much earlier in the month, and so this time around I had the same feeling that it'd be around the 16th or so. But really, when these October events are late October, there's a reason that they're not in September, I guess. They get to it as soon as they can, I guess. But October 30th in Brooklyn, so it's in New York City, which is different, and it's 10 a.m. Eastern time, which means it's 3 hours earlier in the day than if it were in California.
So it tells me about time zones.
Yeah, I know. It's 7 a.m. Pacific instead of 10 a.m. Pacific. And then there's a whole thing where you in the UK, your time will have changed, but then in the US, ours won't change for a few more days.
Yeah, for daylight saving.
Yeah, so there's some real math to do.
So in the UK, normally the Pacific time events are all 6 p.m., but because of a combination of the hour change and the move to New York, this one will be at 2 p.m. for me, which is still pretty good time. So
yeah, not
luckily
bad.
The UK kind of lucks out. Like, I either have a dinner time or if it's in the afternoon.
Yeah, it's 1 hour after I start working for the day. Usually the events are the middle of the day, and so there's the morning news to get to, and then lunch, and then a little bit of a lull, and then there's the event, and it's neatly laid out. But in this case, it's an hour, and then the event, and then the rest of the day to make sense of it all, which is going to be different. And the iPad, the education event that was for the consumer level iPad in March, was also in a different venue. It was in Chicago, which is Central Time, so it's 2 hours different than the California events are.
About that.
So this will be more like that. Except this time it will be live streamed, unlike that March event, which was recorded on video and released in the evening, but not live streamed. So if you're not at this one, you get to see it, as if it were an Apple event for WWDC or Apple or Steve Jobs Theater.
And they did so much work on that March event with the production value of stuff, with the schedule. They had the mini timetable and all the invites and stuff. And then they had the custom slide deck that was so cool, which was hand drawn every single slide. But so few people actually got to see it because the announcements were pretty minor anyway. And so a lot of people just didn't bother watching the videos afterwards, but
yeah,
that slide deck was so good.
Yeah, this time around the invitations, there seems to be maybe up to 100 different variations of the Apple logo on each one of these, which is neat. It's every press invitation is a different one. If you go to the Apple events website, you can refresh and see several. I think not all, but a lot of these.
Yeah, they have 16 on the website about.
Yeah. So that's
on Twitter, correlating all the ones from all the different invites. And they're all different takes on just drawing the Apple logo.
Mm-hmm.
In cool different styles. And then underneath you have there's more in the making. Is that right?
I'm
not saying that wrong.
There's more in the making. That's correct.
It's kind of a weird tagline, but I guess it just means there's more to come. But that is written out in like a handwritten kind of font. Again, kind of paralleling to the iPad event, right? So there's definitely a drawing, design, creative, like Apple Pencil vibe around the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah. There's more parties, like, you know, this is the second event in 2 months, so that is they do that each time. And then in the making, I think like you said, like there's more to come would be like the more natural way to put it. But in the making is this big focus on creativity and creation and what they do on the iPad stuff, which, you know, we'll talk about what we expect in a moment. But like, it makes me a little bit nervous about Macs. It's like, you know, because
you can make stuff on Macs.
I mean, you can, but like, we don't think there's going to be a new MacBook Pro, which is like the production machine. You know, it's like, you know. So,
And also, it is just like a double word. You know, it's just a double meaning anyway, right? It's just a cutesy way. It's a way of saying there's more for you to make, and also, we're making more stuff for you to see. Like, that's obviously like the play on words. So
it's literally fall of end part two.
Macs can slip right in there, and especially for like the, you know, like the Mac Mini is supposed to be like pro focus. So there's definitely going to be like the productivity vibe on everything, and that's going to be the general theme.
Yeah, yeah, and the fact that the there's more in the making bit is like handwritten, you know, kind of is, you know, carry over from the education event, which was the iPad now works with the Apple Pencil. Well, here we think there'll be a new version of the Apple Pencil for a number of reasons, you know, including the fact that right now it's a Lightning connector to pair it initially. And we think the iPads are going to move to USB-C. So some changes needed there. And I like these rumors that, you know, speculate that the Pencil could charge and be attached to the iPad magnetically. Like, you know, if they can pull it off in a nice way that's not like, you know, you're gonna drop it, you know, then and get away from the iPad with a Pencil sticking out charging method, that'll be cool, more natural.
Yeah, because so we haven't to date, and again we're getting closer and closer now, so this might change on a daily basis, but as we record, there hasn't been like a surefire leak of either the new laptops or the new iPads, right? Like,
right.
There have been certain CAD drawings of stuff, but nothing that's like 100% positive. Any of the people that leaked the CAD drawings were saying, oh, we're not as sure about this as other things. But the general gist is like a new smart connector that's on the back and then some weird thing on the side in an iPad that's got a rounded corner screen and the bezels are really, really thin all the way around.
Which that bit like, you can line up with the icon that come out of iOS, you know.
Yep, we saw that icon earlier. And so it's kind of what we've been talking about for a while, right? Like thin bezels that are kind of like the width of the small bezels on the 10.5-inch, but that on all four sides. And you have Face ID somewhere in there. Probably works in landscape and portrait, but only one camera system. One thing I saw on Reddit that was really interesting was, because there keeps being this, Rambo found evidence of like the magnetic connector thing last week. And at the time, I was thinking like magnetic connector smart is the same thing as a smart connector, right?
Yeah.
They've moved it onto the back. So maybe it's more magnetic and people are having this idea that you charge the new Pencil by like placing it on this new magnetic smart connector and it would charge. That was like, I mean, it made sense because obviously That's a better way to charge probably than having to like plug it in and stuff. But at the same time, it was kind of weird in that you couldn't use the iPad really while that was going on because it wouldn't lay flat anymore. So, but what something I saw on Reddit was if the back is still a smart connector, but then the magnetic connector is different. This was their theory, that the magnetic connector is the weird indentation on the side that you can see in some of the CADs, and it's gone so far unexplained. And the new Apple Pencil would essentially snap to the side of the iPad. So, like, if you're holding it in portrait, it would be on the right-hand side, and it would, like, clip on there, kind of like how the Microsoft Surface laptops do.
Yeah.
They kind of just clip to the side, and it would charge inductively through there. So the magnetic connector would actually be different to the smart connector, which would still be on the back, but that's how the new Pencil would connect and attach. That was actually, like, a really cool idea, I thought.
Yeah. When was the fall iPad Pro 12.9-inch with Apple Pencil? Was that 2015?
That was 2015, yeah. They announced it in September, and it didn't come out till like, November the 11th. So, yeah, there was a lead time on it, but that was 2015. And then they did the 9.7-inch iPad Pro in the March straight after.
Yeah, that's definitely long enough ago to, like, revisit how all of this works. You know, not to mention that the iPad gets a big makeover, but just, like, you know, it's fair to have two longer than 1 year iterations of iPad Pro. And then now take the, because like the pencil is kind of an accessory, like the way like AirPods are. You don't need to iterate every year on what they are, and you can expect to like buy it and use it for several years without it changing and being, you know, worse. But I think 3 years is definitely long enough to say all those initial complaints about the pencil, we hear you.
And a smart keyboard as well. It's not just the pencil. Like,
yep.
There's plenty of inelegance with the smart keyboard, especially like there's no, because at the time the really weird thing was that even if you have a smart keyboard, there's no attachment on the keyboard to connect the pencil to either. So, and if, say, if this one does attach on that side, you would then have to, like, obviously the smart keyboard's gonna have to be redesigned because the smart connector's moved to the back side. It doesn't attach on that edge anymore. Like, there's a lot of stuff that's being rethought here. And like the 10.5-inch iPad Pro was a new form factor, sort of, but it was nowhere near as dramatic as like a, you know, going from like the 10.5-inch was kind of like going from the iPhone 8 Plus to the iPhone like 10. No, that's not a great comparison, but like the iPhone was kind of like going from the iPhone 4S to the iPhone 5, right? Like,
sure.
The form factor did change, like the screen got slightly bigger and it was kind of different, but it was still mostly the same. And its bigger brother, the 12.9-inch, has exactly the same external design over both generations. Mm-hmm. So they're definitely due for like the bigger chassis style revamp. And in the 2017 update, they got the cool displays with like ProMotion and stuff, and then this year is going to be obviously dropping the home button, which helps get the screen bigger, but we probably don't expect like a massive change in the screen, you know, the actual screen technology. It's just a lot. It'll be faster chips, new pencil design, new keyboard design, and then the overall like chassis of the iPad makes it look cooler with the thin bezels and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's a big update. Like, if you've been waiting for a big change to the iPad for a while, this seems like the one that's going to get you there.
Yeah, I mean, the 2015 iPad, which is what I've got, the iPad Pro, it was like outdated by the March, because the March iPad Pro added like True Tone and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's what I have.
Camera, like the 2015 iPad Pro got a very poor rear camera, whereas the 9.7-inch got the better camera and it got True Tone. Like, the 12.9-inch is a nice size, like in terms of the screen, but it definitely can benefit from being slimmed down and also like catching up to like the thinner bezel of the smaller one.
Yeah, I'm really curious if the new iPad will get the same camera features as like what the 10R has, where there's only one camera but you get to do the portrait stuff, you know, yeah, for the most part on front and back, because, you know, why not? And if they'll do anything, if they'll have you know, haptics for the first time on an iPad or not, you know, like, maybe you could do that. Maybe, you know.
Haptics is harder, I think, because there's just a bigger surface area to cover. So you'd have to do something fancier with, like, you couldn't just have one motor in the bottom left corner, which is how they do it on the iPhone.
Yeah, you probably want like four.
You need like one in each. Similar to how they have four speakers, even though they only use like two at once, and depending on which orientation you're in. So I think the haptics are probably not going to happen this year, unfortunately.
Yeah, but the camera feels like that. I mean, if not this year, then maybe like for the next revision.
I think the camera they could do this year. Like, yeah, they've already put in the 10R, and it wouldn't be dual, you know, it still wouldn't be dual lens or anything. It'd just be the single rear camera that they have.
Yeah, so we'll see what they do there. I'm really excited. The other thing about this event is that the venue is the Brooklyn Academy of Music at the Howard Gilman Opera House, which I don't know anything specific about the venue. Just that, if this wasn't like the iPad and Mac event, as we suspect, I feel like, is this going to be like a HomePod update for the holidays and the new AirPods and
like music connection?
Yeah, and a new iPod Touch.
Like, yeah, it'd be like the iPod event, but they keep killing the iPods off.
Yeah, is this like the new version of iTunes 13 or something? Like they used to do these September, October music events, but this one felt like that, but. I think it's the rumors are solid enough that we tend to know what to expect, and
I'm sure they have some sort of like music production. They love a music production app demo, so they'll have it in there somewhere. Maybe like upgrade to GarageBand and stuff.
Music
like
memos too, now optimized for the new iPad screens.
Yeah. If you like see the USB-C port, maybe they have like pro audio accessories. They plug straight into it and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like in general, just the venue is just like, the, you know, in the spirit of creativity, not music specific. That makes sense to me, at least. Do
you think it's weird that they seem to only be using Apple Park for events like once a year?
Yeah, we know that they use Apple Park for like internal employee meetings often.
Yeah, like pretty regularly. Yeah,
yeah. Which so it's not a waste of a building, but I mean, part of the appeal of Steve Jobs Theater is that Apple owns their own space with their own like custom made hands on area, and to only do that once a year for the iPhones and Apple Watches, it's too bad. I mean, it makes sense for WWDC not to be able to do that because of just like capacity. But, you know, like the March event, the education angle was clever. With this one, they've been in New York before, like for the iPad. It wasn't even an iPad event, was it? It was just iBooks 2, like textbooks.
Yeah, it was iBooks Author.
Yeah, so. iBooks Author, yeah. So you got textbooks on the iPad and you got iBooks Author to create them.
The original attempt at textbooks on the iPad before they forgot about it and then did the new textbooks event this year, essentially, because that was a big thing in the March event, right? Was they had the new textbook approach.
Yeah.
Partnerships, which again seems to have fizzled out a bit. So they're having a great run with textbooks on tablets.
Yeah. So I mean, like there is some history of like New York and iPads, but this seems to just be like creativity, you know, as the focus. So, you know, it's good to have a theme. It's neat to change the venue up, I guess. So like you're not having people fly out to California two times back to back months, but like it's not so bad actually.
I mean, the Steve Jobs Theater is such a nice venue.
Yeah.
It's a shame that they only at the moment at least only doing it once a year, but it's so nice. And I'm happy they're streaming it though, like
at least.
Because if they'd have gone to like they did with March event and they didn't stream it, that'd really be rough. Like mm-hmm. You gotta have the video.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, this is only 12 days away from when we're recording, so probably 11 days from when release. It's the Tuesday of that week. That Friday, we can maybe assume we can get some pre-orders, and then maybe the next Friday release. The thing is, like, with iPads, they're not as structured as, like, an iPhone and Apple Watch release. It's, like, you know, coming next week or next month or something, and then it's like...
Yeah, it's like, they'll be on there soonish.
Yeah. with the Mac stuff, so we know that we expect a new MacBook of some kind. Like maybe this actually replaces the MacBook Air. Maybe the 12-inch needs to change in the lineup some way because of this new machine. Maybe even the Touch Bar MacBook Pro goes away because of this. Like a lot of things get changed because of this one Mac, which would probably be a good thing. And then we also expect updates to iMac with some change in the display, whether that's True Tone or something else, or True Tone and something else, and then a new Mac Mini. This is coming from Ming-Chi Kuo and Bloomberg reporting. I've kind of got a question mark around iMac Pro. It was released last December, so like a revision in October, November, kind of comes in, you know, around that time, or in December, isn't crazy if there's new stuff to do with it. But we do know that Mac Pro, the modular Mac Pro, will be 2019 at some point, maybe the summer, maybe next fall.
It's got to be WWDC, right, for that.
Yeah, hopefully.
At least announcing it. It'll probably be a classic, I'll sneak peek in it till the end of the year again. But sure, like the developer conference has to be the venue. Like they'd just be doing a disservice if they didn't.
Yeah, and iMac Pro was shown at WWDC, not this current year, but the year before. And so, you know, it's been floating around there for a while. Do you think that gets revised too? Or, like, you know, Ming-Chi Kuo didn't, like, break it out, but also would the iMac consumer version get some feature that the iMac Pro lacks for several months? What do you think?
Yeah, you mean, like, especially, like, the display change?
Mm-hmm. If it's True Tone, if that's all it is, or if it's True Tone plus something else. Like, does iMac consumer...
It's hard because, like... The iMac is 5K, obviously the iMac Pro is 5K as well. 120Hz 5K seems like a reach at this point, and it doesn't seem like the consumer market is ready to have that in there. Like there's no other things on the roadmaps from other companies that have like 120Hz 5K monitors.
Mm-hmm.
But and if they did do it, it would be really weird for it to be on the consumer iMac only and not on the Pro. So I'm kind of leaning towards there will be like maybe. Really like improve contrast, True Tone, more like a more just like a color update rather than the because every year there was like and now the iMac's 50% brighter, like that kind of thing.
Versus, yeah, now it's got P3, now it's they've got
versus some kind of like ProMotion thing. Because my pet theory is that they'll do the Apple external display for the Mac Pro will be ProMotion, like a high frame rate panel. And so if they did that next year, it'd be weird to do the iMacs this year. Like, I feel like ProMotion for the iMac line is probably like a 2019 kind of update versus what's coming in the closer term. So, but you could do like a display update. You could put True Tone on the iMac and the iMac Pro people wouldn't care. Yeah. And I've been following like the CPU for the iMac Pro stuff, like those time frames. If there is a Xeon update, then maybe they can just do a little spec bump to it. But obviously, there's not going to be anything radical because it's still, you know, only just a year old, essentially.
Right. Yeah. Barely. Not even at this point. Just approaching that from the release date. And the iMac Pro got the Siri feature where you can say, hey, and then the word Siri, and it will respond to you. That was in macOS Mojave. So even though the MacBook Pro got it in July or so, the iMac Pro got it retroactively because of its T2 chip. So it's part of the way there with what MacBook Pros have. and you could, I mean, I think we discussed this a little bit, but like the idea of taking a MacBook Pro in like different lighting, but the iMac Pro might be more in the same lighting. You know, that can change based on like your ambient lighting, window open, window closed, time of day. But, you know, I think there was an argument that the MacBook Pro can change lighting way more frequently based on like where you take it than an iMac Pro.
Yeah, I mean, if they do have 120 hertz ready, that would be a really nice surprise, because I don't think people are expecting it.
Yeah,
and I'd rather they do it on one line, even if they have to leave the iMac Pro like dangling around. Like, if they can do it, they should do it. But it just doesn't seem like a consumer level thing this moment. But at the same time, it's hard to know with Apple, because for the original 5K, they kind of jumped the gun a little bit by designing their own like timing controllers and stuff internally that could drive the screen, because the original 5K iMac was pretty cutting edge in terms of the general like PC market.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe they could do like a custom timing controller this time that does 120. Like maybe it's not like you can't just rule it out. It just seems unlikely.
Yeah. So the reason I wonder like what you think about this situation with the iMacs is I know I'm gonna buy one of the new iPads because, like you, mine is the 2015, 2016 model of that generation. Skipped last year's version and like, you know, can justify an upgrade this time. And also, you know, I sold my iMac this year and then just have the MacBook 12-inch, and boy, do I feel the speed issues.
You're struggling.
Yeah, I have been all year. And Mojave, I think, didn't help. So that's too bad. But I feel I need to have a better machine. and there's like specs that I know I want to have, at least 16 gigabytes of RAM and at least a 512 gigabyte SSD, not a fusion drive, not less than that storage wise. And I imagine I can configure an iMac that way. I haven't looked recently, but that it wouldn't be a problem. But now I'm kind of looking from this like new consumer-y MacBook to what are the new iMacs look like, and like how does it compare to like an iMac Pro? And because I'm not opposed to having like the extremes of like portable and desktop, and like having an iMac Pro that is like a big investment. And I wouldn't, there's no way I'd pay like the full retail price for it, like the $5,000 price, but like refurb price or like some sell price or even like use whenever people start replacing them. I think I could feel good about that. But if the iMac line, like there's no way to buy an iMac today, because I feels like it's about to get updated based on the rumors and when it got released, you know, last summer or summer before last. So I'm really curious about that part of it. I'm going to watch that part of the event.
I think a higher end iMac config would be perfectly fine for you. Like the main, the leading difference on iMac Pro, right, is the Xeons, which are like three times as many cores as the thing. But, you know, realistically, you're not doing that much stuff that would take advantage of so many cores like that. Like,
yeah. Well, so the difference between like how I work now and how I worked on, you know, my MacBook Pro when I had that a couple of years ago, not the review unit, but the one that I owned, was I dabbled in video more when it was easier because of like screen size and speed. And so,
but you could do that on the high end iMac as well. Like, you don't have to go to a Pro to do that.
Yeah. And that's where I look at like the RAM and the storage of just like the flexibility of being able to, you know, move around and multitask. But but I feel like if I got, that's another thing is, the way that the Macs age, I feel like if I do make this investment and I spend, you know, upwards of $3,000 on an iMac in some configuration, might an iMac Pro age better? You know, maybe. You know. So it's something I'm going to look at and think about as the event goes on. But I wouldn't be opposed to. I know that True Tone, like in all the testing I've done, is not for me in like any situation. So. I know that I'd be okay with like buying an iMac without True Tone if like that's one of the key differences this year.
I really think the stationary nature of the iMac makes True Tone a lot less important.
I just don't like the way it looks at all ever.
Yeah.
So that's one thing I'm looking for. Like, if the iMac were to like change this design in some way that's like flashy, that would appeal to me too. Especially if I can.
The iMac design is really old.
Like, yeah, that's one of the issues with it. Is like the iMac. Consumer version is like dated as it can be. I mean,
and the iMac Pro is basically the same except it's in gray instead.
Yeah, and that justifies it a little bit more. And like your theory of the iMac getting a redesign and then the Pro version not having it for a while is like, you know, I can get on with that. Like that makes sense to me. that the Pro version is more about like the way it functions and not the way it looks. Something to look at, and I'm getting away from the idea of having like replacing this MacBook with a new MacBook of some kind. You know, I wouldn't sell this one because I know I can't like go to an event and cover it from an iPad comfortably the way that other people can. So I know I want to have a portable Mac, you know, for that. But also like end up with a better iMac than what I had before, but you know, newer. So we'll see what they announce.
Yeah, the iMac design is just. I feel like you kind of feel bad if you buy an iMac at the moment. Like,
mm-hmm.
You get the massive bezels and the big chins and stuff. It's like, ooh.
Yeah, that's why I'm like comfortably looking at refurbished versions right now. And then if the next version, like consumer level or pro, is like nothing crazy year over year, then like a refurbished one's probably what I'm looking at. In either situation. But I feel good though, cause I know kind of like what specs I'm looking for anyway. And so, you know, I could buy today and be okay. I just want to make sure that like, you know, 12 days from now, that decision isn't stupid. So I'm, you know, it'll be like end of the year kind of thing, whatever I do.
Now a long time ago, you had a Mac Mini, right?
Yeah. I did a long time ago. The Mac Mini thing was that I had a MacBook Air and I bought a display, keyboard and mouse to use it as like a desktop, you know, when I started 9to5 in 2013 or so. And so I didn't like opening and closing the MacBook Air and like the way that the display reacted. It was a pain resizing windows and everything. So I bought a Mac Mini to have like an always present desktop there. And that I used that for several years. It was a 2012 model, I think. And it was a good machine, but I just eventually, you know, I did the thing where I want to go laptop only and, you know, sold it off. And I remember I sold it for like almost what I paid for it. It was like remarkably well how it held its value at the time.
Yeah, that was actually ridiculous. And given Apple hasn't updated it, the one that you sold is close to the current one they sell today.
Well, I think the reason it held its value so well is like the 2014 ones or whenever they were, like they were not as good. People liked the older version instead.
Yeah, the 2014 base model was worse than the older Mac Mini because they brought the price down by 100 by making it worse, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Then this, there's obviously so everyone's like kind of hyped up for the Mac Mini update, but I think it's more just, you know, this product's been languishing for so long, it's nice to see it get some attention versus like people queuing up to buy it, essentially.
Yeah.
It's described as pro-focused Mac Mini, or whatever that, it probably just means better internals, realistically.
Modern specs, like.
Yeah. And it probably doesn't, and when I read pro-internals, I see more expensive and not making it prettier. So it'll be like roughly the same design, because there are some Windows computers that are, you know, like small form factors, but they're like really, really small. They're like Apple TV sized.
Mm-hmm.
like mini, you know, like a true interpretation of the word mini.
Yeah.
But obviously they're less powerful, right? Because they're so small. I, based on the rumors and based on just, you know, what it seems like logical, the new Mac Mini won't be that small. I think it'll be about the same size as the current one, but just beefed up to be like a Mac, like a 2018 MacBook Pro specs in, you know, a desktop form factor without a screen.
I envision the exact same casing with like the back I/O swapped out, which isn't that like a plastic panel anyway, like the same aluminum casing. And then, you know, maybe one or two USB-C Thunderbolt 3 ports back there with USB-A, you know, and like maybe, you know, maybe like faster Ethernet, maybe higher RAM out of the box, you know, better CPU, better storage options. But like the fact is you can still buy Fusion drives and I think spinning hard drives without the Fusion part, you know. It was like that probably sticks around. Like when I was looking at iMac.
Wait, on the Mac Mini you can buy non-Fusion drive versions.
Right. Yeah, right. That's correct, right?
Just plain hard drives. That is okay. The Mac Mini is so old. Yeah. It's like you can buy Mac Minis with 4 gigs of RAM like base as well. It's like
it's not so good bad. Idea. So yeah.
So to me, Pro Focus Mac Mini means like SSD only or at least Fusion Drive and SSD. Like it means we're only gonna offer like the more premium configurations.
I would love if Fusion Drive went away this year. Like even
yeah, I
on
hate the Fusion Drive.
Even on the iMac 4K and 5K. Because
but they only just got APFS to support it this year with Mojave.
That's true. Well so they used to sell the iMac 21.5 inch without 4K, right? And they finally got rid of that. So like all yep. the iMacs are Retina. It feels like this year or soon, like really soon, they need to only sell you an iMac with an SSD, you know. And if you need more storage, and like plug it up in the back or something. But like the
Thunderbolt 3, plug it up to an external drive.
Yeah, my iMac that I sold, and I sold it for like pretty close to what it cost, so I wasn't, you know, bummed about it. But it had a Fusion drive, and anytime I felt like it bottlenecked, I felt like that was the reason, you know, was that I was tapping into that spinning hard drive. And that's just, I mean, my Mac Mini had a spinning hard drive brand new and I replaced it, like just totally ripped up the drive and put in a flash, you know, storage drive. And that was a major upgrade to it. It felt like a modern Mac because of that, you know. I didn't sell it because it was like slow. I just, you know, didn't want a desktop anymore at the time, but that would be awesome to see. I mean, I don't think we're going to see that, but like, just for the sake of consumers, the starting prices on anything with a Fusion drive, like Fusion is better than non-Fusion, and you know, it's just a spinning hard drive, but it's still not what a flash storage drive is like out of the box. So
yeah, you can definitely tell the difference. Like mm-hmm. I feel like the Fusion drive helps with like boot up time, but then just using your data, it doesn't have all that stuff cached, so you start noticing it.
Yeah. And when they shrunk the part of the partition that is not flash storage, or the flash storage part shrunk by a lot, right?
Oh, yeah, I forgot they did that. Yeah, they cheated out.
They used to be more generous, and they were like, no, you only need a little bit for the system, and that's it. That made it a lot worse.
That was kind of dumb as well. Yeah. It went from like 128 to 32, I think.
Yeah, so not a good shift there.
No. So the main Mac change is the MacBook, right? Like, whatever this unlabeled, unnamed 13-inch Retina somewhere between a MacBook Air and a 12-inch MacBook, whatever
mm-hmm.
that is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why this whole thing felt event-worthy. Was like, you know, you're not going to do private press briefings or press release with like a brand new design and like interaction model for iPads and this whole new MacBook that is like, you know, even if it's called MacBook with like the same name, like it's some style difference to it that is not what we've seen today. Yeah.
I reckon it's going to, and I think I've rumored back this up, right? It's going to have a fingerprint sensor, but no touch bar.
Yeah, that was Ming-Chi Kuo said that, which was the first time that we'd heard that, you know, they'll do Touch ID, but no touch bar, which is would be a new style, like, because we've not seen that. Right now, the touch bar looks like one piece of material, and there's like a little segment for the Touch ID sensor. We've not seen function keys with Touch ID, because the non-touch bar MacBook Pro has no Touch ID either. So
splitting it up means they can actually bring Touch ID to cheaper devices.
Yeah,
everyone's going to immediately complain why it doesn't have Face ID instead, but I think that's pretty obvious, is that Face ID is still a relatively expensive component and relatively hard to make, and all of that supply is going to iPhones and iPads still at the moment.
Sure, yeah.
And I think there is some possibility that this 13-inch thing is like the future of the Mac laptop kind of design, like a radical change.
Mm.
More realistically, it's probably going to be a 13-inch version of the current 12-inch MacBook with a higher resolution screen.
I can see that. Yeah, I can see that. The Touch ID thing is interesting because it makes me think it'll also like need to have one of the T chips, like T1, T2. Which,
yeah, I'm sure they'd give it T2 and could give it mean some encryption stuff as the
could,
pros.
Which could mean you get the Siri stuff, you know, where you talk to Siri without the button, voice activated yeah. Siri, which would be new for a non-Mac, you know, a non-Pro, you know, machine. And when I try, you know, and like probably not True Tone just because of like cost. But whenever, like we talked about on the podcast, when I had the review unit of MacBook Pro, that's what I appreciated the most. Like the differences were like these things could be consumer features, you know, the Siri activation, the True Tone, the Touch Bar, like those are things pros might not care about, but like consumers would appreciate, you know, and we're getting one of those here with the Siri activation at least. So.
Yeah. And probably like Touch ID standalone.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
I'm assuming it will have the 2018 style keyboards with the chrysalis covers.
with the membrane.
Yeah, with the membranes, yeah. I don't think they're going to introduce... I mean, part of my hesitation here, though, is that they're going to have to do some sort of re-engineering just to have, like, the Touch ID button, not the current, you know, row there. Like, there have to be some tweak.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't seem like this laptop, which is also supposed to be relatively inexpensive, is going to have, you know, completely radical keyboard changes, screen changes, hardware changes. Like, I think if it... To reconcile, like, 13-inch Retina plus... you know, not ridiculously expensive, it can't be that forward thinking. It just can't be.
Touch ID,
it's got to be like an iPhone XR of the MacBook line.
Yeah, Touch ID could just be like the power button is like, it's like the shape and it's got a little bit of an island about it where it's got aluminum around it instead of like being connected to the Touch Bar because it's a Touch Bar, but that it's that same shape and size. It's just instead of the power button, you have the Touch ID button, which still clicks and acts like a button, you know.
And how many USB ports will it have?
I would guess two.
I think it's like your options are one, two, or four, basically. And four is a pro thing. Mm-hmm. So it's either one or two. And ones is what the 12-inch has. Everyone complained about it only having one port. So I think two is probably going to happen. And it's also 1 inch bigger. So they can be like, oh, it's bigger. We could fit another one in. Like,
you know,
they can think up a dumb excuse about it.
The iPad is the new one USB-C port device.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, it's always had one Lightning port, but now it's going to have one USB-C port instead. And it kind of like it takes that vision of like one port for power and I/O. If there's like new things you can do with I/O, hopefully in the future of iOS. But like you can say like mission accomplished. We proved that the MacBook can do it. And like maybe the 12-inch sticks around, you know, goes down in price, hopefully. Even like, reduce the specs on it, like put a smaller than 256 hard drive in it and sell it for like $100 less or something. I don't know. But yeah, two USB-C ports, like having lived on a one port MacBook for, you know, two generations, it's useful, but like I would totally trade the headphone jack for another port. Like having even just one on either side is really convenient.
Yeah, because you have one to plug it in to charge it and then one to actually use for a random accessory.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't be Thunderbolt 3. They'd just be normal USB-C ports.
Yeah.
Any other product that could be the keynote?
Oh, I mean, they could have some kind of a charging mat that you could charge multiple things on.
And then you could get like this case for your headphones, and you could put them on it as well. And it would
Like for the AirPods, it could be a compatible. Yeah, the thing with AirPower,
the iPhone could display the battery percentages for all three of the devices. Yeah. And if you wanted to, you could put two iPhones on the mat, and you could mix it around and put it anywhere. That'd be, you know, Apple should think about that.
I mean, no one else has done it, so they'd be first. The thing with AirPower is like they're getting close to needing to say they need a little more time.
Yeah.
Because, like, I mean, it's been a joke the whole year of, like, where's AirPower? But, you know, I think we said on the show a few times, after the September event, it gets awkward. Like, once that you hit that one-year mark, then your sneak peek preview is no longer, you know, a preview. It's, like, a roadmap for, like, a long time from now. They need to amend what they said because they said a sneak peek was something coming next year, and next year is running out of runway. So if they don't think they're going to be able to do it in December, then I think this event, like whether it's the event or like in PR statements afterwards or something, they'll need to say the thing they did with AirPods, you know, we need a little more time. The thing they did with HomePod, we need a little more time. Like all these, this is a historic history of this happening. And this is like a whole new case of it because of the preview part too.
If they announce they're either going to announce that it's like coming by the end of the year at the event, or with a press release the same day as the event, right? If it's delayed, I don't think they'll mention it until like the end of November, and then they'll be like, then they'll put out a press statement saying it's either been cancelled or delayed.
Yeah,
like, they're not gonna besmirch all the happiness around the new iPads and stuff by saying, oh yeah, the AirPower's screwed or whatever.
Yeah, that's a good point. They definitely need to say something though, because like it needs to be definitive. Like it can't be in a few weeks unless like you're positive on the date. And it can't be like, it cannot be like early 2019 unless you're like positive that like
they need to say a month, right?
Yeah.
They've already said a year, which is 2018, mm-hmm. right? So they can't just go, I think people would flip a lid if they just suddenly went 2019. Just be ridiculous. Yeah. If they said February, which is basically what they did for the HomePod, right? Then people kind of like give them to, like you've got to narrow in your time frame every single time you say it.
Yeah, I don't think HomePod got a month, but it ended up in February. And that's why they need to be like super specific or just say we don't know, because at this point the role AirPower has had has been negative more than innovative. Like, it is an innovation when it ships, if it ships, but like it's also got a lot of baggage now just because of how it was previewed, which still I think would have been fine like if they had released it by September of this year, but they didn't, and now it's still like just kind of lingering out there. And the AirPods thing is like super interesting because I know me, like if I lost mine today, I'd feel strongly about replacing them because like I love my AirPods that much. But there are people who still haven't bought AirPods and who are waiting. Like it's probably not in large numbers of like this crossover of like know about AirPower, know about like the charging case that's been shown. But it's a non-zero number. And as you get closer to like, you know, as you get further away from that preview, like it gets worse, you know? And it's awkward. It's like, do you just do the charging case and then have these rumors of like the new version hanging out there too, you know? But it doesn't seem like we get new AirPods at this event.
Yeah, I think it's pretty clear we're not getting like a second generation model.
Yeah.
That'll be coming next year alongside the over-ear headphones, the like the Beats Studio 3 equivalent Apple branded things.
Yeah, which, you know, they can do any of this at any time, but it's that all feels like fall stuff for like next year, like big holiday stuff, not like, you know, middle of the year. I mean, AirPods ended up being, you know, right before the holidays of a year, and like its inventory was quickly, you know, pushed back until February. So that was kind of like a middle of the year thing. HomePod's the same way, where like this is its first holiday season, so they can release anytime they want. But just like if they're doing it on a plan, then like next fall, that feels like a nice thing to have an event.
Yeah, I think giving the HomePod a little price drop would be quite nice. Mm. Just bump it up for the holidays. Like the software's in a relatively good shape now with both AirPlay 2 and the recent like multiple timers and the speakerphone stuff, which really works really well. I love it, but it does seem expensive for the offering that it is. So if they could give it a little price drop, that'd be nice. I think they're probably not going to do an AirPods case until the AirPower situation happens. And there definitely won't be an AirPods 2 this fall. Like, other companies still haven't really caught up to how good the AirPods are. Like, they're bigger, right, bulkier, less battery life. And people still buy them, like, en masse. They keep saying every quarter, like, the AirPods are selling like hotcakes. The wearables are going mad. Like, they're not languishing around by not releasing an updated model. So they could just carry on selling AirPods through the holiday season as is without much issue.
This week, 9 to 5 Mac Happy Hour is sponsored by Text Expander from Smile. Simply put, Text Expander helps you communicate smarter. If you're not familiar with Text Expander, it's a simple but powerful app that lets you create snippets for things you frequently type or copy and paste over and over again. You can make snippets for short things you type all the time, like email addresses, website URLs, and even today's date. Or you can create snippets for longer entries like directions, reference requests, proposals, or even answers to common questions. You can summon these snippets in any app on the Mac, Windows, iPhone, and iPad using a simple abbreviation. Or you can search your snippets using a hotkey while you're typing. You can even power up your whole team by sharing snippets. I've personally been a Text Expander customer for years. I cannot imagine using my Mac without Text Expander. And frankly, it's way more powerful than any of the built-in alternatives. There's no typing and waiting to see if your shortcut worked. Just type your snippet and instantly watch your short text expand into the correct text. For example, I use semicolon lowercase d to format the current date for file names on every podcast episode with digits. Then semicolon capital D to format the current date with the month spelled out for every episode of 9 to 5 Mac Daily. I also have short text snippets for the complete HTML formatted text that goes into every podcast post. I simply type 925H for happy hour and 925D for 9 to 5 Mac Daily. Then fill in the show notes and links and post. This saves me a ton of time from having to think about the current date and copy and paste the same post template day after day. A few other tricks I use daily include my S9 snippet for typing out site:9to5mac.com for searching Google for specific past stories, and Gcache for appending http://webcache.googleusercontent.com/search?q=cache:. That's a mouthful, before a URL to easily access the Google cached version of a site for comparing changes for stories. I even use text snippets to correctly spell common Apple executive names like Angela Arendt and Luca Maestri without embarrassing myself with typos. These are tasks I cannot imagine doing manually anymore, and there's nothing quite like Text Expander out there. So visit textexpander.com/podcast for 20% off your first year and select 9 to 5 Mac Happy Hour in the Where Did You Hear About Text Expander section to let Smile know you came from the show and support the podcast. Again, that's textexpander.com/podcast and select 9 to 5 Mac Happy Hour to save 20% off your first year and even more time saved typing. Our thanks to Text Expander for sponsoring 9 to 5 Mac Happy Hour.
All right, Mayo, as we're recording, it's we're on the eve of the iPhone XR pre-order starting. So Thursday night, you know, midnight, Friday morning, you can actually pre-order one of these things. And then next Friday they hit stores. And my guess is that like you can probably sleep in and buy a 10R for launch day, like for a while. You just might not get the color you want if it's, you know, like we have no idea what colors will go and what order. But that like it might not be like 10S and 10S max level of like running out of inventory. Just my guess.
Yeah. I mean the 10S wasn't crazy, right? Like,
yeah. Just the fact that you got yeah, just the fact that you have six colors is like you have a lot of choices there. And even, you know, I guess with the XS and XS Max, you have three colors and two sizes. So it's like the same six variety. But it just seems like maybe who this is for is not like the pre-order type. Although I think it'll be quite popular and like, you know, could outsell the XS or XS Max. I don't know if it'll outsell like both combined. Or like what analysts are thinking there. But
yeah, that's what the analysts think. They think the XR is going to be like basically equivalent to sales of XS and XS Max together.
Yeah, I mean it's quite appealing because it's you know ballpark of the like 8 and 8 plus price and like media in between the size there, but it's like so much better in terms of the specs and like how modern it is. And you know, if the XS if the 10 never existed and the 10S doesn't exist, like we just went from like the 8 to this, it'd be like, we finally, you know, the design's different and it's modern. There's a lot of good stuff there, not to mention the color. But so we've got that to look forward to. And today there were on YouTube, like hands-on video experiences based on, I think, like a 45-minute briefing with Apple that Selecky2pers had. So we've not yet seen the full reviews of these things, of like, you know, really testing them and comparing them to other phones and other iPhones. So we're still kind of like not to that level yet, but you know, we're getting there. One thing that we learned this week is that Apple, like, and maybe by the time this is out, this is like totally known, but before pre-ordering, we don't see the accessories for the 10R yet. But we saw a few weeks ago, like a tip that there was going to be a clear case. And then you put together some information this week that like Apple kind of acknowledged it in some countries. And so for the first time, there'll be a clear case for the iPhone.
Yeah, this is weird. Like, we got a tip off with the picture that you see in the story the day after the 10R was announced, right? Like,
yeah,
all the way back in the middle of September. And then we like Googled around and couldn't find anything. And I think we just must have missed it. But Apple never announced their case lineup for the 10R. They obviously announced the case lineup for the 10S with the new folio case and the new color lineup. But for 10R, they on the stage, they didn't say anything at all. Even in these hands-on, they're all caseless. Like, they don't show any accessories. But what's weird is that the press release on some countries, and by some countries, I mean, if you go to apple.com/newsroom, that's the US site. If you went to like apple.com/CA/newsroom, that's the Canadian site. And obviously you can do that for every country code in the world. Not all, but some of the countries had an extra bullet point on their press release that said something to the effect of Apple designed accessories, including a clear case, will be available.
Yeah.
But on the US press release, it didn't mention it, or like the British press release. So it kind of went under the radar until someone on Twitter like mentioned it. And then obviously then I saw the tweet and connected it back to the tip we got like a month ago. And then da-di-da, we have the story. Apple will release a clear case for the iPhone XR. Even today, they have not properly acknowledged this. They released a new press release saying that the iPhone XR pre-orders start on Friday, and none of those ones mention the case of any accessories. So it's a very weird situation. But yeah, this would be the first time ever that Apple has sold their own brand clear, we're assuming it's plastic, case.
Yeah, they did the bumper for the iPhone 4 and 4S where it was plastic and rubber around the border of the phone and like literally no back protection. You know, except for the fact that like, if it was laid flat, it'd have a little bit of a lip to raise it off the table. But like the idea was this beautiful new iPhone with a glass back, show it off, you know, and, you know, the whole history of that. And then with the 5, there were no accessories. And the 5S, they had the first leather cases, and they've been leather since then. And the 5S was with the 5C, with the holes in the back case, which would kind of work better now because at the time in the US, we had the regular tour information and it had iPhone, and it was just aligned poorly to say hun or none through one of the circles. It'd be a little bit better now with no small text in the back, just like wherever you want to put the iPhone label, I guess. Yeah, so we kind of wonder, like, what would they do for the colored iPhones? Like, and so we believe that they will be releasing this clear case. It at least existed at some point, like that, like the gold iPhone 10 did, you know, in the FCC story. I guess tomorrow, like by the time this is out, we'll probably know. Like, you can probably pre-order your case too, like, because usually you can buy the case and it comes before the phone comes.
Yeah.
Or, you know, or iPad or whatever it is. So, and it's just also kind of a mystery of like, will they also have all the colored cases too? Or is it only the clear case, you know, for the 10R? So I guess we'll find out soon. Because
obviously the clear case shows the color through of the phone that you bought.
Mm-hmm.
And the 10R is obviously at least some fraction about the colors. Although arguably it's not so much about the colors as the iPhone 5C was, which was like, all the ads were literally like, this is the colorful one, right? They really sold on the different colors with the 5C. the 10R, I still think it's more sold as, you know, like a best of iPhone XS, but not as expensive, and it happens to come in these different colours. And clearly this clear case is less adventurous, extravagant, whatever you want to call it, than their holy 5C case.
It's less quirky, I think.
Yeah. Because loads of third-party manufacturers make clear plastic cases for all the iPhones, right? Yeah. Apple's just never done one. But no one was doing a case with the whole bottom of it cut out with holes in between, like a cheese grater. It was definitely them trying something different. This one's a lot plainer. Like, it's just a plastic case, right?
Yeah, there's some things about this. Like, for the 10R, like, if you buy the black model or the white model, then it's kind of just like the 10R version of every other iPhone. Like, the color doesn't pop to you. The yellow is similar to gold, but like it's definitely yellow, especially the glass. It's like that's a yellow iPhone. The red, they've done red phones for a few years, not at launch like this, but they've done red phones. Blue is very new and coral is very new. So those ones are definitely about the color. Like the black and the white ones, I mean, those could kind of pass for like ordinary iPhones, I think, you know?
Well, I mean, honestly, the black is like arguably nicer than the black they offer on the XS, because the black on the XS is really space gray, so it's not as
that's my takeaway from the hands-on videos today, was that boy, that actually is black. They're not just calling it black, it is black. I want that on my iPhone. but the clear case thing, you know, if this pans out, you know, tomorrow, you tell us, you're listening now, is I think a lot of clear cases are just really bad. Like from good brands, they make bad clear cases because like all Apple's cases are the most aggressive about being like thin and fitting to the design and like making the buttons feel like they're part of the phone. It's like that tight of a fit and wrap.
The buttons on the Apple leather cases are so much better than like every other third party case I've ever tried.
Yeah. Well, even the ones on the silicone case are like super, like they're not metal or anything, but they're nice. They're like clicky.
Yeah.
And then the big thing is that Apple leaves the bottom open where the gestures are, which is really useful on the new iPhones. And like almost every other case maker closes the bottom for like ultimate, you know, face down protection. I mean, if your business is selling a case, like that's your whole business, then you don't want to leave the bottom of that open on like all your cases. Maybe like one or two of them, but not all of them. And so this clear case has that bottom cut out. I receive, like, every year I get a box of cases from, like, different companies for the new iPhones, and I never use them because, like, I'll go caseless or use an Apple case. But I looked at the box this year, and there was one for the XS Max, and it was clear. So I tried it for, like, 2 minutes, and it is just really thick. And because it's clear, you can, like, see how thick it is, like, how much is case, and, like, how much is phone, how much is case, and, like, you see the clear part of it just makes it look way worse to me. Plus the fact that like it doesn't feel like a non-clear case would, like it's rubbery feeling. It's just not pleasant. And I think Apple's will be thinner than the other, like their party ones have that, you know, we saw the open bottom part of it. You know, is like these aren't the most protective cases. Like they're meant to kind of show off your phone and like keep the profile thin, without being just like a scan or something. But I think that this app, like from what we've seen from the leak, you know, so is that it is different than what you can buy today, like for probably a lot less money.
Yeah, and like Spigen is selling a 10R case, but it has like the Spigen logo on the back,
yeah,
kind of embossed into it, whereas the Apple one is obviously just completely clean. Obviously, the Apple one's going to be more expensive. In fact, the Canadian press release even mentioned a price of $55, which equates to like $40 US.
Mm.
Whereas, like, the Spigen and the other third-party cases are, like, $20 maximum. When I posted this story, I came across a phenomenon that I was not aware of, because I only ever use Apple cases and never have used a clear one, is that apparently all clear cases turn yellow. That is apparently a fact of the current clear case market. Now, I don't know whether that's a function of that's the only way that these materials work, or whether it's just a faction of everyone else makes their cases really cheaply. But it'll be very intriguing to see whether the Apple case is a different material, like we're assuming it's plastic or whatever, but it could be different. And then maybe if it's slightly more expensive, they can give it slightly better materials that don't make it have discoloration.
Yeah, the yellowing thing is definitely real, and I don't know if it's because of sunlight or what it is, but it is very easy to identify an aged clear case. it looks like someone has like smoked tobacco near it for a while, but you can't clean it. Like, this, the material changing, not like being like a coating on it or something.
Yeah, I believe the material is TPU that all these other clear cases use. So in the morning, I'll be very interested to see the specs page for the iPhone XR's case, and is it TPU as well? Because it would not surprise me that Apple's like big thing here is they managed to they didn't do a clear case for this whole time, and then they finally figured out a way to make it not yellow, and then they were like, let's do it. You know,
it would equally not surprise me if their first clear case isn't perfect. It has all the issues.
That is also true. Like, I had the iPhone 5S leather case, and it's like 10 times worse than their newer leather cases.
It was like paper, yeah.
Yeah, and it broke up and stuff, whereas my iPhone X leather case is like still almost pristine like a year later. Like, I'm really happy with the iPhone X case.
Yeah, I think that those first leather cases like felt good on day one, but they didn't age well. And the new ones are like not designed for day one. Like, they feel harder and like different, but then they soften up over time, but they don't fall apart.
Yeah. The one kind of sucky thing that because the XR only has one camera, it uses the iPhone 8 style camera layout where it has the camera and then the flash below it. Whereas the iPhone X and iPhone XS put their cameras in like the elevated bump protrusion. And when you put a case on, it means that it can be like flush because it's raised up and the rest of the leather can just like flow around it. The XR doesn't have that. So you have like the gap in between the flash and the camera where you're just having the raw material. So it's not quite as nice on that.
Yeah, it gets dirty. Aspect. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The clear case thing, like, I'm curious too about how it'll age with the yellowing and like what the material they're using is. But I think there's like definite demand for a clear case for every phone, not just the ones that come in four colors plus black and white. because like people would want to show off their new gold iPhones in the same way, or their silver and white iPhones, or their space gray and black iPhones. Like, I would totally consider one of these as an option. If it's done well, you know, and feels like nice, like the other Apple cases do. So I hope it's popular, and I hope Apple decides to make this an option for every iPhone size, unless it turns out that this was just like a thought and they didn't follow through on it. And that's why it wasn't everywhere.
It's weird that they had it in so many press releases and like,
yeah. And I think the way that we came about it was like, it was in someone's inventory, like and not like an Apple, you know, inventory system, but like someone else's inventory system.
I think it was like an authorized reseller, something like that.
Yeah, so it made it far out there. That's probably real. And I'm, like I mentioned before, I'm curious if they do all the same color cases too, because I could see you wanting to have like, you know, the same
Folio XR case, for instance.
Yeah, Folio or just the you know the colored ones anyway, like the same color mixed colors together. And even though it only shows you like the bottom, you know, of the color of the iPhone, if you have black or white, you might not care. And you know, it might be fun to mix and match colors anyway. And like I said before, the gold iPhone that is like the perfect candidate for a clear case too. And then they didn't make one for that yet. So yeah, the whole XR thing is like, It's $750 new, which is only a little bit more than the $650 price that like most flagships were at for a while before they got more expensive. So it's not cheap. It's like not as cheap as like the cheapest flagships ever were, and it's definitely not like 5C pricing. It is better in some regards than the iPhone X was.
But it is cheaper than the 8 Plus, right? When the 8 Plus was new last year, because the 8 Plus was $799, right? So
yeah. So
and it's got like a bigger screen than the 8 Plus. Like, that's kind of like its closest brethren. It is cheaper than that, and it looks a lot more modern. Like, it doesn't have ugly bezels. Like,
yeah, you just don't get that. But you just don't get the zoom lens. You know.
Yes.
You don't get 2x optical zoom. You know, for a little
or 3D touch.
Yeah, or 3D touch. Which I saw some in some of the hands-on videos from today. I saw people say that they thought it was because it wasn't used much, and I think it's purely price. It was like it cost to put that, and maybe LCD too. Like, can they do this bezel-less stuff with LCD?
Yeah, whatever the liquid retina display is, I assume that to make that happen, they couldn't get the pressure-sensitive screen to work with it.
Yeah, I don't think it has anything to do with adoption of 3D Touch. I think they want it there. That's why they have what do they call it, Haptic Touch now?
Yeah, which is long press, and then when you're ready to let go, it gives you a little vibration.
Yeah, in places where you can't long press to do something else. Because in like you won't get the stuff on the app icons, for example. Or like,
yeah, like the quick actions aren't there. Peek and pop isn't there.
Yeah.
It's primarily the things like... because even the spacebar trackpad, it won't... you won't be able to pressure touch anyway. You have to do the spacebar long press thing, but it will give you the little vibration. And they include like a proper Taptic Engine motor, not like the old motors. So this is like... because obviously before, 3D Touch and the Taptic Engine came like hand in hand. Whereas this one will be Taptic Engine only. So you still get the really nice vibrations and stuff, which is good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, I don't think it has anything to do with adoption. I think it's all to do with costs and like...
yeah, because if it was about like, oh, people didn't use it very much, they'd have got rid of it on the XS's as well.
Yeah.
Like, they wouldn't have kept it around there.
Yep. So,
My family are super interested in this. Like, for whatever reason, I couldn't sell them. My family just wouldn't buy like $1,000 phones, right? Like, my family tend to buy everything not on contract because if you can save up the money, you can save more money by doing like SIM only plans and actually like save a significant chunk of money in the UK at least. So, two of my family are currently on iPhone 6s and they will be getting 10Rs. And if Apple had last year, one of them wanted, like my brother wanted to get a new phone, but I told him not to. Because he wouldn't want to buy the 10 because it was too expensive, and I don't think the 8 and the 8 Plus were like worth it because it was still pretty old. Like, it felt really bad telling. I couldn't recommend my brother to buy like the same ugly bezels in 2017. So I was like, hold out, I'm sure they'll bring the price down. And
especially knowing it won't be like for more than, you know, it won't be for 1 year. It'll be for more than a year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that is essentially what the 10R is, right? Like the bezels are slightly bigger than the OLED, but by and large, you're getting like the best of the XS for $250 cheaper, which is hard to argue against.
Mm-hmm.
And there was all this stuff about the screen resolution. Like, all the YouTube clickbait has all sprung up about the screen resolution being low. And realistically, the screen resolution is perfectly fine. It's exactly what the iPhone 8 had, except it's just across 6.1 inches, not across 4.7. It's 320 pixels per inch. Like, it will look absolutely fine. It's got nice color range and stuff. Obviously, it doesn't have the high contrast on the blacks, but if you actually look at subpixel level, OLED does weird tricks where they like share some of the pixels together. So even at a subpixel level, I think the iPhone XR will beat out the XS in terms of number of subpixels. So if you're that panicky about it, like it's not even like a clear win there either. Like the XR is just a really, really compelling option.
Mm-hmm,
yeah. And it comes in some pretty colors.
Yeah, that's the thing is, in my family, one of my sister just bought a new iPhone recently, and it was like right before the event, so and she wasn't buying the 10, I don't think, just because of the cost. You know, probably bought an 8 or 8 plus, I don't know, but so she told me that she broke her phone or something and had to replace it. And I was like, oh no, there's an event soon. It's going to be really, a really good lineup. And she's like, oh, I don't have an option. Oh, well, okay, sorry. My stepsister last year, when the 8 and 10 were new, she bought an 8 plus because she wanted a bigger screen and wasn't sure about not having a home button, which to me is just like totally foreign thinking because to me it's like home button is old mechanical, you know, like swipey gesture is awesome.
Hands down, the swipe and gestures are like one of the best things the iPhone's done in years.
Yeah,
like,
it's so fluid.
It still feels futuristic, like today. Like, mm-hmm. It's just so responsive and it feels so good.
Yep. So she bought an 8 Plus for that reason. And then she saw my XS Max recently and she was like, if this was out then I would have bought this because I like the screen size, you know. It's like, okay, that makes sense. I have another stepsister, so three sisters total, two-step. And a third one, she bought an iPhone recently. She's the one that I mentioned who bought one for FaceTime specifically, which was funny because like all phones can do video calling for the most part, just do something else. But like FaceTime sticky, you know, so it works. And I don't think she bought a 10. I'm pretty sure. And it was before the new phones were out. I'm pretty sure she probably bought an 8 or an 8 plus, probably an 8. And then my mom bought in a 7 plus right before the 8s came out and the 10 came out. Because she had an SE and ran it over on accident. All of them could update and have a much better experience. And my stepmom, she's got a 5cm engine last week that has like 0 kilobytes left. So it really needs to be updated. But none of them are people that buy the new flagship iPhones or are buying one this year, at least. And so like the XR would be great for them, but they're not going to buy it this year. But like if they bought it next year and it was like the like middle of the range phone, it's going to be a great phone. So like it's got a good future ahead of it. It's just the fact is, right now, it's still a $750 phone, so it's not the cheap one yet. But yeah. that had me looking at the Apple.com and the iPhone lineup, especially for my stepmom and like Christmas coming up, is like I wouldn't buy it for her $750 iPhone or like tie myself to the contract for her. But I could consider like me and siblings going in on an iPhone 7, which I think is a really modern and like decent phone for like for that design. Like 7 to 8, you get the wireless charging stuff, you know, glass back. It's just not, you know, some camera improvements, but it isn't like dramatic. But they sell that phone, Apple sells that phone for $449 brand new. 32 gigabytes, so like the storage is a thing, but it's not like that's livable, especially if you're coming from an 8 gigabyte iPhone. And, but I think that's just a really, like, for like the cheap phone to be the iPhone 7, I think it's a really good phone. And it still comes in 4 colors. You don't get space black or jet black anymore, but you do get the matte black finish or silver or both gold and rose gold. It's like 4 options there. And like, to me, that's a pretty good spot in Apple's lineup to be like the bottom, because like the SE had a point where you could buy it for $449 and, you know, It had appeal for being small and like, you know, the old design, but like, and not a big screen. But for the iPhone 7 to be in that price point, you know, it's pretty compelling for if you want a cheap phone that the iPhone XR is not, you know.
And you see it in the sales, right? All these analysts say that the older generation phones, like the iPhone 7 series, are still selling very well. Like the new generation are the number one, but then like the tier below that is like iPhone 7 still, like. Yeah. They're the entry level contracts essentially at the carrier stores. So, and even if you like the gestures and Face ID and all that stuff is clearly like where you'd want to be if you could get it, but there's just nothing at the price point at the moment. So people carrying will, you know, what they're familiar with, they're upgrading from like, you know, 6s's or 6s and stuff, and it's like, well, I'll go to a 7 or I'll go to a 7 plus. Like, it's perfectly legitimate, and it's not badly priced. Like, it's still not, you know, cheap as chips, but it's not terrible by any means. It's like I'd say it's about right for what it is.
Yeah, I think some carriers had some deals for the SE like to get rid of them for like $160 plus like maybe some kind of a commitment or something, I don't know, like service. And that's like, you know, when you're beating like the iPod Touch in prices, that's pretty good. But for a pretty good iPhone, you know, that the 449 is a pretty good spot. The 7 Plus is like less compelling because it, instead of $449, it's I think $569, which just feels like, because it's not $100 more, it's like $120 more. So it just feels like it's not a very good leap. And then the 8 is I think $599, and then $699 for the 8 Plus. And like, those are like, you know, you're saving some, but you should probably really look at the XR at that point, like, you know, kind of make a decision there. But so it feels like the iPhone 7 to 10R. It's like, you know, in price, it is a big jump, and in like what the phone itself is. But Apple's got a pretty good lineup at the entry level too, better than other years. Like, for some reason, like 7 just feels so much more modern than like 6S and 6 did. I mean, those are older phones. And think about how iOS 12 is like optimized to make something as old as like the 5S, 6, and 6S feel better, like run better. Yeah. You know, so 7 in that regard is not an old phone. You know?
And if you drill down into it, things like Group FaceTime aren't available on like the 6 series, but they are on the 7. Yeah. Or like the new like message effects aren't available on the 6S either. And so like the 7's like the new cutoff for like every new feature essentially.
Yeah, yeah. So iPhone XR, I guess you and I are not going to buy one. Your family's interested. Mine just doesn't take my advice on when to buy stuff. So they're just like out of the circle on this. I do have some family who will buy, like my aunt and uncle, they'll buy like the new high-end stuff. So they would get 10S Maxes if they're upgrading this year. But no one on my side in the 10R camp. But I'm really curious to see like these in the wild, like, you know, how they're adopted. I saw a lot of 5Cs around, and I think a lot of those were like a year later, which is really odd because then it's like a 2-year-old iPhone in terms of specs. But you know, this is new territory for Apple at least.
Yeah, I don't think there'd be blockbuster lines or anything like that, but through the holidays, the 10R is going to sell a lot of them.
If you're buying one, what color would you buy?
I'm going to sound really boring, but and say black, because I would buy black, but I'll exclude the white and the black ones to make it more interesting.
Okay.
I would buy the red.
Huh, okay. I would be torn between blue and coral, depending on how coral is in person and like in different lighting. But I think we omit white and black because they're not new. Red, it's new, and it's red, you know, without a bezel.
But, although I'm pretty sure the black 10R will look better than the space gray 10S, just on the purity of the color.
I agree. Even the white, I saw in one video the two whites compared, you know, what one the single steel silver with the white glass back, like it was just more vibrant of a white. It was like, that's pretty. That's like the iPhone 4 level. So you'd go red. I'd pick blue. I'd say blue because I'm iffy.
Blue is nice.
And coral. Yeah.
For me to pick a blue, it'd have to be like a darker blue. Like this is more lighter. So
yeah, it's true.
And I know I've always envied the reds on like the 8 Plus series and the 7 series, but it's always obviously been out of cycle, so never could do it. So this would be a day one product red phone.
Yeah, my brother had a green 5C. That was the only 5C I ever saw like up close. He destroyed that one pretty quickly. So he had a green 5C with a black circle case. It's kind of a cool design. Yeah, so we'll see. This is one phone that I'll never own, just like the 8s. Although the 8 I got to use for a few weeks before it was out. But 10R, it's curious, and I think it's good for a lot of people. But it's, you know, it's not for us. But I'm glad it exists for a lot of people.
9to5 Mac Happy Hour is brought to you by LinkedIn Jobs. It's no secret that hiring the right talent for your company is hard. It can feel like a full-time job all on its own, but LinkedIn can take the guesswork out of hiring. That's because LinkedIn is more than the world's largest professional network. It's also a better way to find great talent. The way it works now is you post a job to a jobs board and hope you find the right person for your job. But if you think about it, how often do you check job boards? For most people, it's a pretty occasional thing, but there is a place where people go daily to grow professionally and explore job opportunities. In fact, 70% of the U.S. workforce is already there. It's LinkedIn. You already know LinkedIn as the world's largest professional network. And here's the thing. It's also a better way to find great talent. Just ask any of the hundreds of thousands of businesses who have posted on LinkedIn Jobs over the past year. And because LinkedIn considers skills, experiences, location, and more to match and promote your job to potential candidates, businesses are rating LinkedIn Jobs 40% higher than jobs boards at delivering quality candidates. 22 million professionals view and apply to jobs on LinkedIn every week in every industry, even yours and mine. If you're not using LinkedIn for your hiring needs, there's no better time to start than now. Just go to linkedin.com/happyhour and get a $50 credit toward your first job post. That's linkedin.com/happyhour for your $50 credit today. Terms and conditions apply. Our thanks to LinkedIn Jobs for sponsoring 9to5 Mac Happy Hour.
All right, Mio, let's talk about the big event that Phil Schiller was at this week. Not the Apple event, but Adobe Max. Michael Stieber went there for 9to5 Mac, and he had some excellent coverage. He got a lot out of the event. But the big story was Photoshop on iPad, like real Photoshop on iPad and not like Photoshop Touch or some mobile version. Historically, Adobe, like I used to cover them more before Stieber joined us. But historically, their strategy was take a feature from an app like Photoshop or Lightroom and make that whole feature its own app on iPhone and iPad. And, you know, you have like a whole folder of Adobe apps called Photoshop, but it's like one feature out of Photoshop. And I guess that worked, but it wasn't what people wanted. So now they say that they have full Photoshop with desktop sync and this new cloud format coming next year, which is a big deal for iPad, right?
It is. And when the original iPad came out, I feel like Photoshop was always that app that people were like, this would be so good with a tablet because you can touch it with your fingers. And then all the critics would be like, you know, a tablet's never going to be powerful enough to run Photoshop. Like, you're always going to need a computer for that. And clearly that hasn't panned out that way. Like, at least in terms of raw processing power, the iPads are well on their way to be able to run, you know, an edit as fast as a laptop or an iMac even. Like, there are still some limiting hardware problems at the moment with, like, RAM and stuff probably. Like, just the sheer amount of RAM is so much greater on a Mac than it is on an iPad. Like, the iPad currently maxes out at 4 gigs, and I'd be surprised if that changes with the A12X. Like, I don't think it's going to go up much more. I guess we'll find out. But the chips are not slow. Like, they can definitely run the core Photoshop engine. And it isn't just a port of the Mac version to the iPad. The foundation is the same, and it means your documents will be cross-compatible, but they're building like new UI on top of it. And in some of the interviews, Steve even explains how they're not necessarily going to bring every new feature to the iPad or every existing feature. They're kind of using this new platform as a way to like refine it down, similar to how Apple did with like Final Cut Pro 10, where they dropped a lot of the legacy from the older Final Cuts and kind of started over. And it seems like that's what they're doing here. I think it's a nice like landmark, and you can see why Apple's like excited about it, right? Like, this is something that could really, really work on the iPad, either with your finger or using the pencil, right, as a stylus to draw and select and do everything you can. And there's just this, like weight behind the Photoshop brand that, you know, Pixelmator or Affinity Photo just, they just don't have it. Like, you can't walk into a business and be like, switch the iPad for your creative needs, we've got Affinity Photo. Like, they'll just look at you blankly. But if you can walk in and say like, we have proper Photoshop, you know, that's a different story just for the name. And then as long as it can deliver on, you know, most of the major features that everybody wants with decent performance and capability, like, I think it's going to really do well. And it helps solidify, you know, the iPad as post-PC, probably one of the biggest landmarks on that journey in a long while.
Yeah, something I was thinking earlier and forgot to mention when we were discussing the iPad rumors and expectations is that, like, with the iPhone, there were phones, the iPhone 10, there were phones that looked better than the iPhone 7 and before. With the iPad, it's like, you cannot find a better tablet than the iPad Pro right now.
You can barely even find a tablet at the moment. Like, everyone else keeps stopping making them.
Yeah, well, you can find like single one-off generations of like the latest attempt from like X company, but like there's
the
no...
best competition at the moment is like Microsoft Surface.
Yeah, exactly. There's no what was the company Essential that had the phone with, you know, almost bezel-less, but it had like a little peninsula, you know?
Yeah. It did have a little chin as well, but it was pretty good.
Little chin. So, yeah, so it's like, with the iPad, there's nothing like that. Like, we don't like the chin and forehead, but we take it, and there's nothing better that we're like, Apple, do that. And now they're doing that. Like, they're like catching up with the iPhone. So in that regard, like the iPad is there's not a lot of competition for it. I guess competition is like PCs. Which is like the whole marketing campaign. But this is cool. I mean, they're showing Photoshop on current. It isn't like there's like, you know, unreleased iPads or like only on the feature iPad next week or something. You know, these are made for current iPads. Is there any way to cut off like what iPad it can run on? I know in the past you could do like a hack, like exclude iPod touches because they had no camera, but then really
This is complicated. You can't explicitly say in the App Store, I don't want to be on this, and this device. There are about like 30 different capabilities, they call them, of different features that you can say, I need a front-facing camera, I need a 64-bit processor, I need this, this, and that. And then it will automatically cut off ones that don't meet those standards. The problem is, there hasn't really been a generational feature like that on the iPad for a long time.
Right.
It's hard to find something that could actually cut off older models in a clean way. The closest I could think up is like an AR kit requirement, which would cut off like the older iPad Air and the products like that. But if you're a normal run-of-the-mill developer and you require AR kit in that way, you have to like justify to App Review why your app requires AR kit. Like
you need to use AR kit, right?
Yeah, and even if you like use it as like a one tiny feature, App Review might be like, well, you can just hide that on older devices. You don't need to require everyone to be like that. Like, you literally have to have AR be the central way the app works for that generally to fly. Now, in Adobe's case, they're obviously suddenly Apple's new best friend when it comes to this stuff. Like, Phil Schiller doesn't go on the keynote stage for many companies at all. So they're obviously very pally and clearly collaborating on this in some regard. So I'm sure they could get away with it if they wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
What they probably will do is what a lot of the 3D games do on the App Store at the moment, which is just cut off what they can, and then in the description they write, we do not support this on X, Y, and Z iPad.
Sure, yeah.
Which is kind of like the hack, the way to do it, which isn't very elegant, but it, you know, gets the job done.
I guess on the Mac it's the same thing, right? It's like you can run Photoshop on a machine like mine that will let you have a bad experience, you know?
Yeah.
Like Mac OS Mojave would run Photoshop on a Mac Mini with 4 gigabytes of RAM, you might have a bad experience, you know.
And it depends what you're doing. Like if you open a photo an image in Photoshop and all you do is crop and rotate it, then you're probably going to be all right on a 12-inch MacBook. If you try and do, you know, advanced color adjustments and all these like clipping masks and all these effects, then it's going to slow down like a foghorn. Like, you know, there's a spectrum.
Yeah, that makes sense. So there might not be a clear need to even have like you know, only the iPad Pro, like trying to use ProMotion or something, if you could even do that as like a reason. But like it might not make sense to cut off older devices in that regard. It's let the user see what wall they hit instead.
Yeah, and even quite older iPads can run Affinity Photo and they can run Pixelmator, and you know, stuff is slow when you're doing like the transforms and the perspective effects and stuff like that, but if you're just moving some layers around, cutting some things out, even, you know, pretty old iPads can do that pretty well. So
yeah.
I don't think there's a direct need to do it. Obviously, if you're going to be loading up, you know, the kind of Photoshop documents that people that use to make magazine covers like you would on a Mac, then you're going to need newer hardware, right? Like at least the 2017 revisions. And maybe even some stuff will be exclusive to the iPads coming out next week that we just don't know about yet. Like, for instance, with the newer engine on the iPhone XS, right, they made a major jump going from, you know, 800 billion operations to like 5 trillion, for instance. There could be some hardware accelerated features coming into Photoshop that maybe Apple's given them a heads up on, and maybe there'll be a demo about at the event, potentially. Although I'm not sold on that because it's the Photoshop's still like a 2019 vague thing, like it's not coming out immediately.
Right.
But because it is the Adobe name, like it does hold weight and hold some stature there. And so in that case, they could limit individual features and just not show them on, you know, the older models. But I don't think there's a direct need to cut off the entire application.
Yeah, the closest thing I can think of, like how Apple handles this is with a lot of the camera effects. Two things here. So on the iPhone X, if you take a live photo and you go to the photo viewer and you swipe up to apply an effect to a live photo, like loop or bounce or long exposure, my experience was that those took a few seconds to load. Like you had to wait. It was one of the only times in the iPhone that I can recall where it's like a system action, but you need to wait for it to process. It's better on the XS and XS Max. It's one of the things that makes me feel better about the purchase than not. Cause I use it a lot. But it's still not instant like applying a filter would be. Cause I guess it processes. But aside from that, like they do restrictions on what filters you can, like what camera effects, like portrait, you know, can do, you know, like on the XS you can do, like the live preview of what the effect will look like for the you know, where it has like the black around you, whatever that's called.
Yeah, stage light.
Yeah, stage light. And on the 10, it's not a preview, but it's like, you know, a guide.
Circle.
And then you see it after you take it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And obviously the obvious one is like the bokeh blur stuff on the XS, and yeah, they could probably do that on the 10. It would just be slower, for instance. Like,
yeah. And we learned today, like, clarify that the 10R can do front-facing, the black effect, whatever it's called, he said, but not...
Yeah, you can do stage light on the front, but not on the rear camera.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah,
and so, obviously the 10R's like a weird portrait mode because it's not using dual camera disparity. It's doing like some... It's more aping what like a Google Pixel does with its one rear camera, but I don't think Apple's as good at it. So clearly they're having to turn some things off, like the stage light modes.
Yeah. So those are examples of like Apple taking the system and like limiting features by necessity. But I think it's probably right to expect that Photoshop will just run as good as it can. And it'll give you everything. And it's up to you to have the right device to get the best experience out of it, which makes sense to me. Like maybe you can run this on an iPad mini 4 or 3 or whatever runs iOS 12. You just won't have the same experience as you, like, in terms of like performance and like, you know, not getting frustrated as you'd have on like a brand new 12.9 inch iPad Pro 3, you know, for example. That makes sense to me. What do you think? Well, a couple of things here. So first thing is, in one of Steber's interviews, and we'll have all these in the show notes, I think he asked about Marzipan and like the idea of eventually Apple taking this app and making it the desktop Mac version of Photoshop. You know, if you have the ability to take your iOS apps and run them on the Mac, develop, you know, ideally like one set of code and make minor adjustments for it to run on the Mac, like, would that work? And I think the answer he got was like, no. Not with the Photoshop audience. Like, that would, like, in the same way that like Final Cut Pro users freaked out, like, it would be even worse for like the Photoshop audience. So,
and part of this is we don't know yet exactly what the Marzipan offering is going to be.
Yeah.
Based on the current apps, obviously it's really bad, but we're obviously hoping the final product will be better. But yeah. I kind of see like they're building out this new experience on the iPad, and it'll eventually proliferate to other platforms, but they'll probably keep around like Photoshop Classic on the Mac forever. And if they want to do the newer one, they'll call it like Photoshop
10.
Yeah, exactly. Or something like, do you know what I mean? Like, they'll separate it out, and it's getting most of the features, getting like all the big features, but there's going to be like weird edge cases and legacy stuff that they're not going to port over.
Like, there might eventually be a point where you want, you know, you run both, and then eventually you only run the new thing and like the old version. You know, it's got a few features that you wanted, but there's more features that you now rely on in the new version. Yeah, I mean, it was a little confusing to me to like, it's the full version on the iPad, but it's not the Mac app. You know, it's like. To weigh those two things and make them make sense to me took some explaining.
It's kind of weird because they even make a big deal of it being Photoshop on the iPad, not Photoshop for the iPad, but it's not a direct port. Like, it's the foundational core is going to be the same, but the way they build on top of it is going to be gradual and in some ways exploratory. Like, when it ships, they're not going to have every single feature of the desktop app. That's their headline aim, but it's not the reality.
Yeah, I think it helps to understand just like how messed up their previous strategy was of like taking a feature in Photoshop and calling it Photoshop Touch, Photoshop.
Yeah, like, they'd have like Photoshop. They'd have like Adobe Brush.
Yeah.
Touch for iPad.
Yeah,
that was the original iPad 12.9 inch demo. They had Adobe on stage, and they had that guy demo like three different apps, and he switched between them, and he'd like copy and paste it to the next app, and it was just like, you know, you could just make Photoshop.
Give me one app, and that whole thing.
Yeah,
yeah.
Do you think they have been given? Because I saw some people were like, now Apple and Adobe are clearly very pally. They have Schiller on the stage. They had the press. Apple did a press release announcing like Photoshop on iPad as well. Do you think part of the reason they're doing this is Apple's like giving them hints on the future roadmap of the iPad, or would they have done this on their own anyway? And Apple's just kind of like taking advantage of it because they're doing it.
I think Apple's had 3 years of pushing this idea of, if we have an iPad Pro, this isn't our consumer iPad. And they've probably done a lot of lobbying to Adobe to get to this point based on the current hardware. And I think there's some references to this too, as like Apple's shown a commitment to this, you know, this level of iPad. Like, there's a big difference on like the web browser iPad and the fact that they still sell, you know, not just like old iPads at a lower cost, but like new iPads with a different set of features at a consumer cost. Like, that is, You know, like, there was a point, like, with the iPad Pro that I felt strongly that it was actually, like, the iPad Air 3. Like, there was no difference to it. The one that I have now, like, it feels like the iPad Air 3. It just happens to work with
the 2016 one. Yeah.
Yeah, it just happens to work with a pencil and have a smart connector. Well, now there's one that works with a pencil, just has no smart connector, which isn't really used for anything. But I think we've come away from that with stuff like ProMotion, like, features that are really nice and kind of on the extravagant side, but that are harder to appreciate, you know, and like you pay more to have nicer things that, like, not everyone would enjoy. So having this, like, split roadmap of, like, what an iPad is and how it updates every year, I think that's more to do with this that Apple's shown. You know, I mean, iOS still has some maturity to do so many things, like the ability to, like, read a flash drive and you know, to me, like, 11 and 12 messed up multitasking worse than it already was. There's, like, a lot of figuring stuff out to do. The home screen layout on the, especially the big iPads, is just atrocious to me. Like, it does not take advantage of the big screen size. It's like, you know, a 3.5-inch iPhone is the same system as a 12.9-inch iPad. Like, it's like if your Mac was stuck in Launchpad mode. you know, it's crazy. Like, that stuff isn't what sells it. But the hardware side is like, look, you know, we've got a commitment to high-end features. Look at the last two iPads over 3 years. And, you know, you don't have to show something off that's been unreleased to make them. And the story, like, it isn't brand new this week. Like, Adobe's previewing it. But Mark Gurman at Bloomberg had the story with Adobe confirmation, right? Yep. Like, several months ago. So he found out about it, and then Adobe wasn't coy. They were just like, yes, we're doing that. you know, and here
this
it is.
This is the first, like, public demo of it, really.
Yeah, and I really doubt that, you know, a year ago, Apple's like, look, next December, we're going to have this killer iPad with no bezel. And
yeah, there was a quote on the Verge cast. Neil Patel did, like, an interview with one of the Photoshop people. And it kind of got taken out of proportion. Like, Neil, I asked him about, like, what do you think about the Apple Pencil with the iPad and Photoshop? And the guy was like, oh, you know, we're obviously have a nice collaboration with Apple. We can't talk about much, but we're really excited where it's going. And then everyone was like, they've shown them the new Apple Pencil, blah, 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 Apple Pencil 2. Like, I think it was a pretty vague statement that could have just meant Apple's told them that they're not going to, like, drop the pencil after 1 year. It's a long-term thing for them, but I think you can take Apple at its word, and, you know, Phil Schiller telling somebody to do Photoshop for iPad because they're serious about it is enough. Like, they don't need to have, like, this. I don't think they're enlightened with all the new iPads that are coming out in 2 weeks. Like, it's just an Apple style.
Yeah, I wish they could tell Instagram to make an iPad app. They're really cool. I think the pencil angle also gets a little bit blown up, like, just on its own, because it's nice in Apple's marketing, because for the longest time it made the Pro different than the non-Pro. That's not true now with the new, you know, consumer iPad. But, like, even for Photoshop, like, there are things that not just the pencil, but touch, like, direct manipulation with your finger on the screen versus, like, a trackpad, is good for. And, you know, I think in the marketing we'll continue to see the pencil be pushed heavily, but that in practice, like, it will be nice in, like, situations like drawing especially. But, like, I imagine there are lots of workflows in Photoshop that would be better with just, like, you know, nothing else in your hand but, like, you and the iPad and tapping around, like, dragging your finger around. And they're not going to, like, advertise that as much, because it's one thing that makes the iPad different from other tablets and, you know, computers and stuff. But, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if, like, a lot of people just really enjoy using Photoshop on the iPad, you know, when it comes out without a pencil too, you know. The access to this thing is going to be, like, if you pay for Creative Cloud, you get the app, right? Like, that's how all the Adobe CC apps work, is you pay. Well, I guess they have, like standalone versions too of desktop apps, I think. But that you can subscribe monthly and you get, like, the latest version of everything. And this will be in that category, so it's not like you pay extra for it from what we expect. And then the, like, current Photoshop solutions for iPad, their model, I think, for the most part, is, like, you pay up front.
Yeah.
So do you think that'll be a factor for people who are like, you know, I'd rather use Affinity or Pixelmator Pro coming, you know, for the iPad, you know, pay once and do maybe an inferior version or a different version, or, you know, subscribe to Photoshop and have, like, the real thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think the people that Adobe are targeting are kind of the people I mentioned at the beginning who just wouldn't even bother looking at it because it has a different name. Like, there's so many people who, like, graphic designers in the world, right? And you can tell them about Affinity Photo till you're blue in the face, but they're never going to change their... They're never going to up in their workflow to swap over to something like that. Mm-hmm. Like, for me, you, and, you know, most people in the... Most average people, just buying Pixelmator or buying Affinity Photo... I think Affinity Photo is better at the moment. They're doing Pixelmator Pro for iPad, but it's not out yet. Like, just buying Affinity Photo in one go will happily satisfy everything you need to do. You can cut out all the layers, you can do adjustments, you can do effects... You'll be perfectly fine, right? The very, like, obscure... And they have plenty of... Like, Affinity Photo is a very powerful application, and it is, you know, a one-time purchase. But I think the people they're really going for with Adobe Photoshop is the people that already subscribe to Creative Cloud, to be honest. Like, yeah. You'll just be using it a different place, and it'll be like, you know, next time when you're thinking about changing your computer, why don't you buy it on an iPad instead, like, and then do it on that? Like, you'd still have... I think a lot of people are going to have, like, their iMac stand and desk. And then they're on the, like, they want people to use an iPad, not a laptop, when they're on the road. Or you can, like, because this cloud PSD thing is kind of like Google Docs, where it's just, like, seamless. Or, you know, like iCloud Drive, where it's just, like, seamless device-device sync. So it'd be like, you can do some stuff on your computer, and then you can just take your iPad somewhere else and do some sketches, do some edits with your fingers, and then, oh, you need to go back to the computer, and you can carry on, and it's one-to-one. It's not like you import it and this thing's different, or you import it over here and that's different. So I think they kind of target different markets. Obviously, there is overlap, but I wouldn't tell somebody to go and subscribe to Photoshop to do what you could do if you could buy, you know, any of the competitors today, but... There are plenty of people who just... The key feature is PSD compatibility, like,
yeah,
with their existing documents and their existing systems. And only Adobe is really going to be able to guarantee that.
Yeah. Nice. So we'll see how that goes. It's a 2019 thing. So 2019, we get a Mac Pro, and we get a
Marzipan.
Marzipan, yeah, for everyone else. And we get Photoshop on an iPad. So that's neat.
9to5 Mac Happy Hour is sponsored by Capterra, the free resource for finding the software you need for your business. Have you ever been assigned a new task at work with no idea where to even start? We're all bound to face unexpected hurdles at work. Don't let finding the right software be one of them. With 2019, fast approaching, you don't have time for unexpected hurdles to derail you. Find software for your business fast with Capterra's new free ebook, The Big Book of Free Software, which you can download for free at capterra.com/happyhour. Capterra.com is the free resource to help you find the software you need for your business. And with helpful information on over 300 different software tools, their Big Book of Free Software can help you find a completely free tool to test today. And it's absolutely free, so you won't have to ask your boss for a penny. Whether you're looking for a new project management tool, recruiting software, or an email marketing solution, Capterra's Big Book of Free Software has something for you. Visit capterra.com/happyhour today to get your free copy of The Big Book of Free Software. That's Capterra, CAPTERRA.com/happyhour. Capterra.com/happyhour. Next thing, tell me about the situation with subscriptions. I know there's a story this week about subscription abuse and how Apple's leaning on subscription revenue for their services business and how it isn't being managed as well as it could be. So what's going on with that?
Yeah, so this isn't exactly a new phenomenon. Ever since Apple rolled out the in-app subscriptions for anyone, because originally it was limited to newspapers and publications only, those kind of apps, and then 2 years ago, 3 years ago now, they opened up the ability for anybody to be allowed to run subscription-based applications with auto-renewing. So if it's month-to-month, the system automatically bills you every single month.
And they incentivize it because the split goes 70 Apple, 30 developer to what after 1 year?
If you keep a subscriber for 1 year, it goes up to 85 to the developer, 15 to Apple.
Okay, yeah, there we go, yeah.
So it's a pretty hefty increase, right?
And yeah.
Versus if you, like, say Tweetbot, right? If you sell someone on Tweetbot 1 and then you sell someone on Tweetbot 2 the year after, like, they're still a Tweetbot customer, but because the app's different, they wouldn't get a 50% bonus on those sales. So it definitely pushes people to our subscriptions. Obviously, Apple has told everybody that they're into the subscription game, like in a big way. They have the services revenue targets to double the revenue. They have App Store revenue going up overall. Like, you know, they really want people to adopt subscriptions, and they give them monetary incentives. It makes sense just from a, like, if someone pays me $2 a year, then it's going to give me more incentive to keep the app updated versus paying me $2 once, then I have to fight again to get them to pay them $2 another year and a half's time. Like, I'm not against the idea of subscription tote. I think some companies originally, and maybe even still, kind of took the mick a bit, where they took like a $10 one-time purchase and made it like a $5 a month subscription. Like, there was definitely some recalculations of stuff that's having to happen. But this report in particular is about not the companies that are being a bit cheeky, it's the ones that, it's like the apps that are being, you know, downright deceptive and misleading.
Sure.
And the prime case here is, with free trials in being in the picture, is that apps would present a screen, and this could be like a calculator, right? Like a malicious app that's just trying to make a load of money. It launches the app, and then it immediately shows you a big button that says free trial, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you can unlock whatever rubbish features are in it. And then in a very, 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 very little writing beneath the button, it says, after your free trial ends, you'll be billed at $5 per week, right? And $5 a week times 52 weeks is like $250 a year. And this was one of the example apps, and I think it was a QR code scanner, right? Like, clearly, $5 a week subscription for a QR code scanner is ridiculous.
Right.
But this app had been climbing the App Store charts. I think a company called Sensor Tower guessed it had made like $1 million plus.
Yeah.
Like, just by confusing people, essentially, right? And then you could look at the reviews and everyone would be like, one star, one star, one star. This app charges loads of money. One star, one star, one star. And rinse and repeat that kind of model over and over again. And you'd have other apps which would not show you, which would ask you to do a free trial. And then the close button of the modal, like, alert would not show for like 5 seconds. So the only button you could press was the buy button. And then after 5 seconds, the close button will come really, really small in the corner. Like, clearly these people are trying to get you to buy this stuff, get customers to buy this without really knowing what they're doing, right? Like, and it's bad. Like,
and there are App Store rules against this already, so it isn't like we need like a new set of rules for it, right? They're just, it's not
more about enforcement, exactly.
It's like discovering the problem and enforcing it is difficult to do. And they're just taking advantage of the fact that, like, To use the App Store, you kind of need to have a credit card hooked up to your account. And so you kind of need to have a really fast buy button. Like, Apple wants you to do that. It's hard not to do that. And these guys, these apps are just taking advantage of that in, like, deceptive ways, huh?
And an app review was not being vigilant enough in stopping it. Or one other tactic is that, because generally people believe that if you have a $10 a month subscription, app review takes longer, like, takes more care in reviewing your app for legitimacy than if it was like a 99 cent per year subscription, right? If the more expensive apps get more scrutiny. But something that you can still do today is submit your app with a $1 a year subscription, and then after it's approved, go into App Store Connect and just change the price. So and that doesn't require a re-review, right? So I think that's what a lot of these apps were doing. Like, the QR code app was probably on $1 a year. And then after it got through the App Store and had like a couple of updates, they then shot the price up and started showing all the purchase dialogues.
Yeah.
And this obviously culminated in some articles in TechCrunch and Forbes, and it all kind of bubbled over the top. And then they called out like 12 specific examples of really bad apps, including one that was actually featured in a WWDC slide that had equally deceptive practices. So that one especially is not very good. But all of those, all of those 12 got pulled eventually. Like, Apple obviously responded. And now, later in this week, it seems like they've done a more concerted, systematic effort to kind of re-review some of the worst offenders. Specifically ones that kind of that try to do bait and switch with a really big button that said, you know, 1 week free trial, 1 month free trial, with then like really, really small text that would say the actual price of keeping this up around.
Mm-hmm.
And if this got worse and worse and worse, clearly it's bad for the ecosystem, right? Then customers become really scared to buy anything in case it has these weird subscription terms attached. They become hesitant to even download an app because in their mind they'll start attaching subscription payments with this. Like, if you got run into this out of the blue and you didn't realize, you'd be really, really worried about downloading any other application from the App Store.
Yeah, let alone one get with an app purchases is very scary.
Yeah.
It's like a warning label.
Let alone one that was actually a legitimate subscription app. Like, it just kills your enthusiasm, right? Like, if you ended up losing, and these apps are like, it's with a recurring $5 a week subscription, like, that money adds up so fast.
Yeah, like subscription fatigue is one thing, and it's very real. But, like, subscription deception is, like, way worse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it seems like Apple has done something relatively systematic this week, where they've kind of reviewed at least, like, the top offenders and basically told them all that you all need to be better about this, or we're not going to approve you. Like, they just rejected loads of them at once. And they haven't made, like, an official policy statement on this, but as you said, it's already covered under the App Store guidelines. So theoretically, they can just do better enforcement and do it. I think they need to close the loophole where you can just change the price at any time, because that seems really dangerous to me.
Sure.
Recently, they've done stuff where you can't change the description without doing an app update, or you can't change the what's new text without doing an app update. Like, all this stuff is they've implied, but you're still free to change the price of the app at any time without any purview from any higher party. So that definitely needs addressing. Kind of jumping off that, in general, Apple needs to do more to help the subscriptions be easy to understand, easy to find, and easy to cancel.
Yeah.
This is their big platform, right? This is their this is the way they want to increase their revenues, whether it's through iCloud storage subscription, whether it's through Apple Music subscriptions, well, you know, whether it's through just all these random App Store subscriptions adding up. Like, they have to do more here. Like, this is their core new business growth, and it just feels very antiquated in how they handle it at the moment.
Yeah, you've got two ideas here in the notes, and one of them I think is tricky, and one of them is like, I can't believe they're not already doing this. In terms of, like, the challenge here is with Apple pushing subscriptions, like even you know, with its own services like Apple Music and iCloud storage and all the features that come along with that, it's like, you don't want to send a push notification every morning on, like, someone's wake up screen, like, good morning reminder, you're still paying $10 a month for Apple Music, you know, whatever. But it needs to be like, I think even right now, the current way that you find your subscriptions, it feels like you're using some old system. It's better than it was, but it still feels like you got to like unnaturally dig in through like mislabeled settings and like wait for
Let me ask you, right? Web view. Could you explain to me in a sentence how you saw your current active subscriptions?
No, I would without looking it up or like poking around, I'd say like go to settings and like tap your face and look around.
What you have to do is you go into settings, you click iTunes and App Store, then you click the Apple ID link, and then you have to click view Apple ID, and then you have to wait for this random web view in this page to load. You have to do loads of other stuff. You have to authenticate your account. Then you have to scroll down, click subscriptions. Then you have to wait again for an inordinate amount of time while this creaky old system loads. And then you will see your current subscriptions.
Yeah, the part where you have to say like view Apple ID or like tap on tap your email address, that's the part where it's not obvious at all. And then the part where it has to load in, like, it needs to be like hard coded. It's like just like any other settings, you know, toggle is just like how you can manage your alerts easier. When it has to load in like that, it feels like, am I doing this right? Like, is it?
Yeah, as soon as you click view Apple ID, you're basically looking at a web view. Like, right. That's how bad this system is. What it needs to, the managed subscriptions needs to be like on the App Store app, not buried in settings. It needs to be like plainly obvious. They just need to make it easier to find for number one, right?
Yeah.
Just make it easier to find. I don't care where you should have a link on like the homepage of the App Store that says like current subscriptions. There you go. Like, you've already solved one problem already.
Yeah.
My other idea, and I do think they should do this, is if you delete an app, it should ask you if you want to cancel any subscriptions that are associated with the app. So in the QR code scanner example, right, it's almost self-regulating. You download the QR code app, you freak out about it, clear the app's kind of rubbish, so you delete it. In the current system, the subscription carries on. It will just keep charging you forever until you manually go in and dig out and cancel it. I think if you delete the app, it should pop up and say, you have an active subscription with this application. Do you want to cancel the subscription? And you can say continue or can say cancel. And if you press cancel, it just stops the bill for the next month and you're done. Why doesn't it do that already?
Yeah, yeah. I think the best example of that system and function today is HealthKit. Like, if you have a health app that has access to HealthKit, like you give it permission, and you delete it, you have to make a decision when you delete it. Do you want to keep your data in health without the app installed, or do you want to also remove that data from the health app? And that's like, you know, privacy concerns is well considered for that reason. But a similar dialogue for like, if I'm, you know, on a Showtime video trial, you know, I've paid $0 and I watch a show, I see I don't really like the service and I want to cancel it. If I don't also put a date in my calendar to remember to cancel a subscription and like do it right now, then I'm probably going to forget. And then I'm going to get an email that said I paid $10. And then I'm like, oh, I paid, didn't even have the app installed. I've got to go and, you know, find out where to unsubscribe through Apple. That's not good. So I love your idea of delete an app with a subscription attached to it, you know, give a dialog box with a link, you know, an easy way to end the subscription.
Yeah, because it shouldn't automatically cancel it, because you could have the app on another device, or it could be a service that is partly on the web. Like, say if you had Netflix, right, and you deleted the app off your phone, that doesn't mean you want to cancel Netflix. It just might mean you don't want the phone app anymore. You just still might be wanting to watch it on your TV.
Yeah.
But just showing it up, saying, and just telling you how much you're going to be charged if you press no. And then that would sort out so many of these problems, because even if you got fooled by the QR code thing, right? I'm just using the QR code as an example of
that.
It should be a subscription. But there's plenty of these, like games, anything. Right? So your free trial elapses, you start paying. You get an email, or you look at your bank account and you're like, what is this money? Oh, it's this app that I don't want. I delete the app. Surely in most people's heads, you deleting the app means you're cancelling this payment. Right, but that's just not what happens. And then next month you get charged again. Like, so at the very least, I feel like it minimizes the chance of exposure to like a 1 month or a 1 week, because a lot of these subscriptions are weekly, you know, margin of error. Like, it just can't, it helps legitimate subscriptions, because you just generally might forget that this app you're deleting had a subscription, you want to cancel it, and it helps lock down the scammy stuff from spreading too easily.
Yeah.
And then one other idea I have, which isn't in the note, but I'm going to bring up really quickly.
Sure.
If you're doing a subscription where it is like an introductory offer, and then it goes over to actually a paid plan, the first time you start paying, you should get a notification on your lock screen.
That'd be good. I would say about that.
Yeah. Your free trial has ended for blah. You are now getting the premium upgrade for $4.99 per month. And then if you could get a button on the notification that says stop paying or cancel, or you just dismiss it and it carries on. Like, it doesn't have to, every single month, you don't have to get a notification that you're going to be billed. But for the first time, I feel like that's perfectly acceptable.
I even think like the first time and annual wouldn't be so bad. I pay for Feed Wrangler, which is David Smith's like Google Reader RSS replacement, and I paid for it since it came out because I relied on Google Reader and it went away. And they're like free options, but I liked his service, using his service with the Reader app. And every year, like a few weeks before it renews, he automates an email that goes out to you and says, you know, heads up, if you want to cancel, now's the time to do it because you're about to be charged again. And that feels good. And it feels so bad to get duped by a free trial turning into a paid service. Like, I've got on my calendar right now to end a trial a few days before it becomes a paid, you know, service. It's like the evaluation period, you know? And for annual stuff, it's like, it's just happened with me in Prime, like Amazon Prime. I've decided I don't want to renew again. And you can fix it like after it happens, but sometimes the renewal notice for me is getting charged, and it's like, oh, I just paid for a whole year. Well, I've already paid, so I might as well keep it. Next year, I'll cancel it. It's like they kind of rely on that mentality in a lot of ways, and like it's way more consumer friendly if you let you reevaluate each time. And I could see like weekly and even monthly. You know, I don't want to. I already get an email receipt about Netflix every month. I don't want the choice alert too. So by default, I like the idea of trial becomes paid and annual, you know, renew, because it's probably a larger amount than a couple bucks unless it's, you know, some of the newer stuff. So yeah, I like that.
Yeah. Like, and this isn't just some like theoretical fear. Like, obviously we have the 9to5 Mac app, which runs on a subscription business. And I have an app on my own now, which is a yearly subscription. Like, if you screw over customers accidentally, or, you know, because it's not Apple screwing them over, really. It's these, you know, naughty app developers, but it's Apple's problem.
Sure.
If you screw over those people enough, they stop becoming customers, like, because they just get hesitancy and they don't want to do it. Like, I also think there's a huge problem in getting anyone to buy into a subscription, let alone an app store that's riddled with fraud and deception and people paying when they shouldn't. Like,
yep.
Even just the straight up problem of getting people to download an app and pay for it is hard enough. Like, and these new attack abuse vectors have been going on for a while, and I think only now Apple's like actually done a decent response to it. And it's not just, and you can't just have a decent response today. You have to pick this up so it continues, you know, forever, essentially.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what Apple Pay, and that's what the 30% cut is partly for. It's for funding the being vigilant and policing this stuff and making sure that apps aren't, like, at the very least, they should have someone examining the top 100 charts, right, of ranked by grossing revenue from subscription. And they can just review that. Like, if this weird app that nobody's ever heard of suddenly shoots up the list, they should be able to check that out, realize that it's a scam, right, determine it's a scam, and then press a button, this is app review or part of the app review team, that refunds all the customers, right? It should get, if it's scammy, it should not, the users should be paid for it, right? They shouldn't just lose all their money and then pull the app from the store. Like, some of these apps apparently making like multi-millions of dollars a year, right? And I can tell you for a fact that very few apps make multi-millions of dollars a year. It is not an insurmountable problem for a human to review that list of like 5,000 apps, right? Mm. Or a couple of people. Like, because obviously you could whitelist a lot of them, like Netflix or YouTube and that kind of stuff. But if new things come on the board, it's worth giving it a second eye to make sure, you know, that you are actually protecting your customers' trust, your customers' money. Right, it's just they need to do more than what they're doing.
Yeah, makes clearly sense to me. Yep. All right. Before we wrap up, I want to go through a list of a few things here. Just to end on. First thing is a Skydio R1. It's an autonomous drone that this week the Apple Store began selling. It's been out since February, but now Apple sells it too. But it's a drone that primarily you launch like from your hand or from the ground. It's really easy to launch from your iPhone, and then it follows you or like does effects around you, like goes way up high or spins around you. It's really neat how it's like programmed. This week they not only showed up in the Apple Store, but they have an Apple Watch app, which is not true of any other drone that I know about, and it's because their main focus is like self flight with you as the subject that it tracks. That they can have a watch app, because like you wouldn't navigate a drone on your wrist and like, you know, lose it and that'd just be a terrible experience. But what Skydio does is they have it finds the subject, so you or another person or even a car, and it shows thumbnails of that on the watch, and you can scroll through the screen and like tap the subject, anyone in its view, which is really neat. And then it has like dozen plus modes of like follow you in front of you, follow you behind you, follow you beside you, something called orbit where it like goes way up high and then comes back down. They do things like where it rotates around you, tripod mode where it stays still and then you move and it tracks you from a fixed point. So some really neat stuff of like the drones, the cameraman. It's pricier than other drones, but it's got some really cool autonomous stuff that would be, you know, neat if it comes down in price, especially. But I got to try one out with the watch app, and it's really neat. What I did was go on a bike ride, and just have it follow me and then have it go in front of me. And even doing that stuff, like having the phone mounted to my bike was neat as the viewfinder. But once I kind of trusted that it wasn't going to fall out of the sky, which is kind of nerve wracking, or like hit a tree. You know, then I could just like just use the watch with my phone in my pocket, because you still need the phone nearby for it to like connect. But the watch can be your controller for it. And you see the drone battery percentage, which is only 16-minute battery life per battery. I had two to test it with. And so halfway through the flight, you know, we were 16 minutes in, I landed it and changed out the battery and then like put it back up in the sky. And it was just neat to be able to do that. And like for a bike ride or something, like showing off where you are, it's really neat to capture like a quick clip that you can, you know, put together with other clips or just like post on Instagram or something. So that was neat to do.
Yeah, I saw your video of it, and it looked pretty smooth and stable, and pretty nice cinematic tracking of you on the bike.
Yeah, I tried to trick it and like go on a sharp curve, go in like a very heavily treed area with like wooded area, and I was really impressed. Like, it's expensive at $2,000, but if you're looking for something serious to film with like this, then it's a neat solution. I've not yet tried car tracking, which it can do. Like, it promises to do that with different modes. But like, the idea is you can like open your sunroof and like let it go as you're driving at top speed, 25 miles per hour. So you've got to go below that. But at one point, I didn't share this part of the video, but a car came beside me as I was riding my bike, and the guy was like, "Is that filming and following?" I was like, "Yeah." So he waved to it, and then like the car, it was really neat. so I was quite impressed. So Skydio R1, check it out. It does have some modes like where you can navigate from the iPhone, not from the watch. That's just for like changing the mode. But there's a lot of cool stuff packed into the watch. You can even use the digital crown on the watch to like pan and like spin it, rotate it, which is, I thought it was a clever use of like the actual watch hardware. So Skydio R1, check that out. Check out our story on it. The other thing I want to mention is last week in this spot of the podcast, I mentioned that Nike Running Club, 10 days plus after the Nike watch came out, they didn't have an app update for it. They do now. So yay, it's just bigger, like fills the screen, but that is so much better. Like, as you're on a run, you can glance at your wrist, and now you have a bigger watch. You've got bigger numbers, so it makes perfect sense. They don't yet do anything special on the new infograph modular face. So same problem as a lot of other apps in Apple's apps, where you can't launch the Nike Run Club app from a complication yet. I would like that. But they're making progress. Another thing I want to mention is, for the past 2 weeks or so, like since the Series 4 came out, I've repurposed a Series 3 watch that was refurbished that I had for like boring reasons, but it wasn't like my everyday watch. I didn't use it. Now I use it for sleep tracking. So what I do is I take my Apple Watch Series 4 off at night and charge it like I always did. And then I literally put on the Series 3 watch, and it's in... It's muted, it's in do not disturb, and it's in theater mode, which keeps the screen from coming on. And I'm using Auto Sleep, the app, to track the sleep stuff. And it goes to HealthKit, and it goes in the health app. And there's like no start and stop or anything like that. The only thing I'm doing is just charging my watch and changing out the watch that I'm wearing. And part of it was just curiosity of like what data will I find, and like what will it reveal that I can change. And the big thing has just been, I never get 8 hours. And I couldn't have told you that. Like, I would have thought I was getting like 7 hours and doing well, but I'm getting like 4.5 hours, 6.5 hours max. And it's been kind of insightful and seeing that. The other thing that I'm going to try and see if I can make changes to improve that. But the thing is, you get 24-hour heart rate data that way, because you sleep with a watch on. Suddenly you've got, forever battery, because it's two watches. And you can do this with an old watch too, but if you have a new one laying around, like it's another option than like versus selling it or giving it away or something. But I found that you need to turn off the low heart rate alerts on the newer watches, because if your heart rate goes below like say 40 or so, you'll get an alert, and as you sleep your heart rate goes down it naturally, and so that alert isn't tuned for sleep tracking, because the watch needs a third party have to do it. And so I turned that off, because like I woke up and I didn't get an alert for it, but it was in the notification center of like, and it tracks in the health app of like 12 instances of low heart rate alert, So it's like, turn that off.
Yeah, I had that happen on my Series 4 watch. Just like, I dozed off on the sofa at the weekend, and then I woke up and it was like, low heart rate, low heart rate, low heart rate.
Yeah.
And there's no option to like take it, like the lowest limit is 40. Like, you can't have a below 30 BPM option. So
yeah,
your only real option is to not sleep or turn it off.
Yeah, so I've got it off on the sleep tracking watch, and then on my regular watch, and like my walking heart rate isn't going to drop below that. Like, it'll be in the 40s and I'll be happy about that, but it's not going to go below that unless I'm actually asleep, and then it'll be like in the mid-30s. So that's been going well for me. Some people ask me like, what's the point? And it really is just like to collect more data, and like, it's just interesting to like put a number on this stuff. But I've never found a good way to charge like in the shower or like for an hour here or there, and then reliably not have my battery die like in a bad time, or like, not track some activity I want to. But this solution, You know, like I looked at the resale value of that watch and it wasn't going to be satisfying to me. And so it's anything to do. I would never go out and buy a second watch for this purpose. But if you have one that's older, then it's a nice way to repurpose it.
Yeah, I still have my Series 3 watch, but I can't sell it yet because I stupidly updated to the 5.1 beta. It's a bit bad to sell it on that. So I'm just holding on to it until I can eBay it off. Probably a couple of weeks.
I've always had stainless steel watches, and they've always held their value really well. But my Series 3 stainless steel did not. Like, it sold for about half of what I paid for it, and it was still under warranty, too. It was crazy. I was disappointed. But this is just an aluminum model, too. So, like, and it's kind of neat. Like, every morning I go from, like, a glance at this watch that's, like, this size, and then, like, I put on my watch, and it's like, oh, this is a nice screen every day.
It makes you appreciate the big screen every single day.
Yeah. So that's something. I've also, you know, I like to use this space to mention running. I've gotten way more into it again. And it's the end of the year, the weather's cooling off, and I'm just so happy about that. Like, the humidity is lower. It's just really nice. And so I've signed up for like a number of 5K races, which are just like, you know, it's just participate in. And then one half marathon, which is at the end of November. I was signed up for one just like last year in December, but I think I'm going to skip out on that one or just like watch it or something. But the one that's a little bit sooner, it's like 2 weeks sooner, is end of November, but it's around a space center down here where I live. So I think it'll be a neat view, and a friend's going to run it too. So looking forward to that. I'm not quite in the shape I was in. Like, my best shape was like when I ran a 10K, and I was really happy with that race. I'm not quite there yet again, but it's been motivating, you know, to have these things on the calendar to look forward to. So as those things approach, I'll you know, obviously have the watch and everything and share experience as it comes up. And the last thing that's kind of newsy here is today the Amazon Echo got a new feature that was introduced, announced a few weeks ago, called Whisper Mode. And the premise is the voice assistant won't always yell back at you whenever you talk to it in like quiet environments, which can be good for like if someone's sleeping or that situation. So now the Echoes will detect if you whisper and it's pretty good at that, unless like audio is playing, then it's trickier. But then the voice assistant whispers back to you, and
that's the weird bit.
Yeah, that's kind of getting a mixed reaction. There's some cleverness to it, where like if you whisper to the Echo, it will detect it and recommend whisper mode for you, and like gives an example of what it's like. Or you can just tell it to use the mode, and it detects like your volume level each time, to either go from whisper mode or not whisper mode, like normal. So that part of it is intelligent. It's just the whisper mode itself. Like, I kind of think the volume might be the same. Like, it can be actually noisier because of like how whispers can come across. Plus, it's just kind of weird. Like, I think the ideal feature like that Apple should probably do is like survey the ambient noise of like your request, what's around you, and like map, you know, match the volume output to that. Like, if you have volume 100, you know, it's like your last volume, but like now it's quiet. That Siri should probably be like pretty quiet too. It's tricky.
Yeah, it should talk back to like the same volume that you talk to it. Like,
yeah.
It's weird to me that this Echo thing synthesizes a whisper, like, and it responds like that. Like, just reduce the volume and just talk normally.
Yeah, it's tricky, I think, because like a whisper is, and they have a paper that they're publishing, or they've published about this, of like how they did it, the technique. But like a whisper is pretty distinct, whereas like low volume could be low volume up close or yelling at a distance. Like, you know, that can be tricky. And like if you're at a distance, you don't want the HomePod, like Siri, to be quiet. You want it to be louder, like to compensate the distance. So that part I think is tricky to work out. The whisper thing is just like, It's if it detects whisper, then it should just reply back with like low volume.
Yeah.
I'm gonna try and demo this so you can get an idea.
Oh, here we go.
Yeah. So if you have the Echo things nearby, you might want to avoid having them triggered. But here we go. Alexa, what's the weather outside?
Tonight's forecast has clouds and showers with a low of 81 degrees.
Yeah, and if I were
it's
to
so weird.
Carry on, like, you know, it has a follow up mode where like the ring lights up and then you can speak again without saying the hot word. And then you can say something. If I like went to this volume again, then it would reply back in this volume too. Like that part of it's clever. It's just the whisper part of it is like distinctly creepy. and I think like could be noisy, you know, because of like the something about like the raspiness of it all. Like it's just like a different tone.
It like punctuates every word just because of the way the whisper works.
Yeah.
It's very weird.
So I think it's a mixed bag on how well that it's intelligent and it's on the right track. But I think like if Apple decides to copy this in a few years, then there should be more intelligence than that. So
before Apple starts worrying about whispering, they just need to get the nice machine learned voices across more than just a US female. That's what I've been waiting for.
Yeah, that's true. And this is only in the US and only with US English, so it's a little bit limited. But there's whisper mode.
I think it's stupid.
I think they're onto something, but it's not quite right. I'll
definitely need some more thinking.
I will report back as a dad with a 5 and 1 year old if this is something I actually use or not. It is tricky though. Like before the call, I was trying to demo it to you, and when we were going back and forth from like whisper to not whisper on accident, like it's tricky. So there's whisper mode. And the final thing I want to mention this week is 9to5Mac and all of our family podcasts are now on Spotify. So you can search for 9to5Mac Happy Hour on Spotify, 9to5Mac Daily, 9to5 Google Daily, Alphabet Scoop, and Electric and 9to5 Toys Daily. Those podcasts are all on Spotify now. So if there's some reason you want to listen to your podcast on Spotify, you can. My understanding is that Europeans with Teslas, this is the way to listen to podcasts for some reason. Maybe like TuneIn isn't there or something. I don't know. But hey, check us out if you want to listen in Spotify now. So it's
next week we'll be overrun with European Tesla listeners.
For Electric, it actually is I think quite nice. But
yeah, that's true.
Yeah, we'll see how it goes for us. But they recently opened up submissions for anybody and not just like special basis. So we're in as an option, and we're also like I think I tried last year, like for the longest time the show was only on iTunes and RSS apps, but you know, podcast players, but I guess we're on TuneIn and Stitcher and all the other guys too, but I still like Apple's podcast app the best. And if I didn't use Apple's podcast app for like the reasons of Apple Watch streaming and HomePod, then I would use Overcast. So how about you? That's the Happy Hour podcast for this week. If you like this show, let us know. We are on Twitter. I'm at Apollo Zach Benjamin. You are
BZA Mayo.
And you can email us at happyhour@9to5mac.com. And we'll be back next week with the Apple event preview. A little bit more detail there. And we're coming up to it. So see you guys later. Bye.
Bye.